Kia ora, everyone. Good evening. This is Monday number 26. This is Andrew Crystal. This is Thursday, the 6th of October 2011. This is the first of the Monday closed seminar sessions. Today, our special guest is Ken Hudson, the loosely say multimedia artist. We've got Bob Dobbs, and we've got an active environment that we're always trying to plumb the contours and lineaments of and try and figure out what it is. Thus far, we know its name, maybe Ion, lurking in the background. So good evening, everybody, and let's see what we come up with today.
Ken, what are you interested in? You've listened to some of the Mum shows, and you've looked into McLuhan for years. What's on your mind today, in general, that you want to be part of this?
Oh, well, you know, I think that the discourse, you know, at this level, trying to, you know, make sense of you know, one's own experiences of media, one, you know, kind of past this sort of dogmatic interpretations of media, you know, to surf the media, as it were, to not be overwhelmed by it. I think that's always such a germane topic. And I feel that, you know, the work being done here is, you know, not radically outsider, but, you know, depending on who you're listening to, it can be fairly radical, you know, and looking forward rather than constant retrievals, right?
Yeah, you know that I'm saying I don't think McLuhan's language is applicable after the 80s, and I use Croker's language. I've always done that, but it was more my adaptation of Croker and the Five Bodies. But I'm now in this context just quoting and using Croker, and I'm open to people saying, no, McLuhan is relevant. You know, we may get into that. But now, Ken, you've done a lot in media. You do Second Life. You still do that?
Well, you know, 5 years ago now, I ventured into Second Life as part of my role as an educator, educational technologist, and trying to, like, determine, you know, is here's an off-the-shelf solution that one could customize for virtual educational experiences. So, you know, in a sense, I never swallowed the pill, as it were. You know, I'm looking for some kind of pragmatic solution with an off-the-shelf tool set.
And, as a teacher, you know, as a teacher, Ken, right?
Yeah, designing educational and training experiences for other faculty members. But, you know, as someone who's, you know, seeing this opportunity space and sort of jumping in and trying it, and for myself, you know, as I say, I never really felt like I was like a virtual world devotee. I was trying to, as we all do, I think, you know, in this day and age, find a leg up in this form, which was, you know, fairly new and fairly cool, to try to, you know, apply it in some sort of practical manner. So I'm often, you know, called by my avatar name, which I don't mind because, you know, I have a reputation in that space. But, you know, I heard you in another podcast, Bob, talk about, I wish I knew the phraseology, we were talking about Second Life specifically, but how it satisfied certain, well, primal urges, right? The, you know, sort of the, you know, the sexual stimulus connected, you know, connected plus the anonymity connecting with people, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of that going on in any form. It doesn't have to be Second Life. But for me personally, you know, I was looking, you know, in the same way flight simulators have been used to train pilots, here was an off-the-shelf solution that didn't cost millions of dollars that almost anyone could try out. And how could you leverage that for some kind of educational benefit, first-hand experience, as it were, replacing the first-hand experience with some success.
Right. Now, I saw you did Eric and Logan. Did you do any other people? Levinson, I think you did.
Yeah, Paul and Bob Logan and Eric all came into Second Life. We did a media ecology seminar there. Again, just trying to sort of explore this kind of space and bring some ideas forward. You know, we had a couple of good sessions, and, you know, I don't think we did anything very groundbreaking, you know, in retrospect. You know, at the time it seemed very futuristic. And, but you know, it's nice to play with these things, and you know, had a lot of positive feedback and so forth with that.
But did you do other people?
No, it was just the three, just the three.
So is it more than being on the phone and having visuals?
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity there to combine identity and context that is fairly profound if it's channeled effectively. So one has a reason to be there. So I identify with my avatar. I feel like that's me walking in that three-dimensional space to some degree. And then the context of which something is occurring can support or detract from that experience. So, you know, in a social context, maybe let's say I'm dancing at a nightclub. And so, you know, I have that feeling that that's my avatar. I have some, to quote Carpenter, you become what you behold, right? I mean,
yeah.
That is me there, right? There's no distance, and it's not like like a quasi-identification. It's a full-on, you know, kind of participation with the avatar as self. And
what you're seeing. You're saying what you see, you start to feel that's what you are, not the body, chemical body image.
Yeah, no, I think very strongly there's a high degree of propensity to commit fully emotionally and psychically to that experience. And then if the context supports whatever activity one is participating in, I think you can have a fairly you suspend all the disbelief that I'm controlling this with a mouse and all of those things. You know, you're numb to those experiences. Instead, you're participating in the image itself. You know, in the same way, you know, in a flight simulator, you know, you're in the cockpit and you see these visuals, but the context and that I have a task to accomplish of flying or landing the plane, you stop thinking of it as a simulation. You start thinking of it as a real experience. And
right.
Interestingly, you know, the research suggests that people who participate in these virtual experiences remember them as if they happened in real life. And so just like we're having a virtual meeting at this moment using the telephone, you know, we'll get off the phone later tonight and we won't say, well, that was a really great virtual conversation that we had, right? We'll say, well, that was a good conversation, good discussion.
Yes,
and
so that's an interesting point. You're saying that memory is not virtual or real. It can be anything to memory. So memory is the integration of that.
Yeah,
that was
well,
completely
I think that's,
missing
that,
from that discourse at the time.
What'd you say, Andrew? Be clear
that
or loud.
Largely, that dimension, the memory dimension, was largely omitted from discourse about virtual reality at the time during the mid and early 90s.
Right. The one guy was Darren Topps who did the book Memory Something. Remember that?
Memory Trade with McGeech.
With who?
He had a co-author, I think McGeech, I believe.
Right. But, you know, this point that Ken's making doesn't come across in his book. I don't recall that. It's very interesting that memory is the thing that has no problem with – all experiences are the same for memory. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. I mean, one remembers – we only have the memory of something that's already happened. So as we recall it, we recall not only the mixture of what factually happened, but also the emotional tone that we experienced. Any other stimuli that might have, you know, people say they remember things because they smelt a perfume or something, right? So memory is, you know, literally a complex, right?
Yeah, it's like memory is tactile. It's neither visual, acoustic, none of those sensory limitations. But another thing is you only start dividing up the medium of the memory image where it came from when you're talking to others. See, when others come in, and then you tell them, well, this I did on the computer and that I did in physical terms. You know what I mean? It's the memory itself in isolation is pure. It doesn't matter whether what medium it happened in. But it's only when you engage in social communication that you have to say the difference to the other person.
Yeah,
the
form
of
the experience becomes the context. Yeah, the form becomes the context.
I don't know if it's a form. What'd you say, Andrew?
Yeah, it's interesting that going out of yourself then evokes that distinction, and I wonder to what extent that is just simply historically conditioned, whether it's a function of our decorum or whether it's part and parcel of this nature of when we talk to another, we go outside of ourselves.
Well, we go into a space, definitely outside of ourselves, into a shared space that is not us. It's an agreed upon space. It's called the public space.
Yes.
And people are always gauging how what they personally experience will go down in the public space. That's the confusion. You know, McLuhan says in Cliche Archetype, people, you know, by the 60s were starting to confuse private and public awareness. Remember that line?
Yes.
But the point is, it's the public space is always there judging, and people are thinking they're being judged. But and then McLuhan says that the private citadel of consciousness or citadel of consciousness is not affected by media, but media is the public spaces. That's what it is. And then that's why media affect media. They don't affect us. They affect media. So print affected the social space that manuscript culture was in. Electricity affects the Gutenberg. So that's always in the, you call it, I guess, the public forums. But memory seems to be something different, at least personally. That's very interesting. Remember how McLuhan went on in the 60s about we're in a memory theater?
Yes, yeah. It was a big deal.
Yeah. He said Finnegan's Wake was a memory theater. So there's the mixture, you know, where memory does come from interacting with other people and other scenes, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely a mix. And the key figure in this discussion in terms of virtual environments or so-called virtual environments and other forms of virtual reality is a fellow at Stanford, Jeremy Bailenson, Bailenson. And a few years ago, he suggested something that I had already experienced in virtual environments, which is that he says that our virtual identity is not separate from our physical identity, which summarizes that fairly.
Ken, I'm sorry, I got interrupted. Could you say, what did this Bailenson do?
Yeah, Bailenson's a researcher at Stanford in virtual environments and how people behave and how experiences that occur in a virtual environment translate into changes in physical behavior. And the quote that for me really struck me as true at the time was, he said that our virtual identity is not separate from our physical identity.
And that might be, identity might mean memory.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly would include memory.
Yeah. So he's saying that people have virtual or chip body experiences, and that becomes part of their physical body or something. It influences their physical body. And see, why wouldn't it? What's the problem he's trying to solve?
Well, actually, he's just trying to understand how it does or to what degree. So his experimentation involves obese persons who exercise in a virtual environment, and over a period of time, they see themselves, their avatars actually lose weight.
Oh, I see.
And then translating how that affects, you know, real-world behavior. And he found that, indeed, people who exercise in a virtual world and see their avatars becoming more, you know, pumped or whatever, buff, actually have that behavioral change to a high degree in real life.
Wow. Any thoughts on that, Andrew?
No, I guess... I'm thinking about Croker now. I'm wondering whether Croker is dealing with this relationship between virtuality and memory and identity.
I don't recall him. He does talk about virtual. You become. He does a whole thing on history and the virtual history files, a whole chapter, and he talks about how that takes on a life of its own and is not chemical body, physical body history. He definitely. Croker works on the point that technology has come alive, taken a life of its own, and he actually gets particular. He says the genes leave the physical body and merge with the data sphere or the cybersphere or the virtual technology, and they only have been occupying our physical bodies temporarily as a means to get to the data sphere. And if you notice, Andrew, on my chart, the Tanyo chart, I have each quadrant is a part of the DNA, with the Dobbs quadrant adding in the RNA. So I've got the genes merging with technology in the tiny note chart. So yeah. Anyways, the genes take on a life of their own, and the chemical body is a lasered. He takes every organ, the eyes, the feet, and he makes them separate floating organs, and they are usually have some phrase over them like lasered eyes or hypertext feet. You know what I mean? He merges the organ with some aspect of virtual technology. But that is what's happened to the chemical body. The real thing is the genes leaving, exiting our body. Oh, yeah, definitely Coker says that the memory gets confused, but the this point, the way Ken brought it up, that the memory doesn't distinguish.
Well, yeah, you know, anyone who's had, you know, an emotional reaction to an email or a voice message or a tweet or something like that, I mean, should, you know, that almost seems self-evident, you know, that that, you know, you have, you know, you're extended into a place emotionally. It's not just that, you know, my body is hooked up to this, you know, my body includes my emotional states as well.
Ken, what impact has this had on your art? Like, I was just reading over your website, and you're here as an intermediate media and performance artist and doing other things. Have any of your new works tried to grapple with some of these issues? Like, what have you done in the 5 years since these experiments in Second Life?
Well, you know, I think that in a sense that I was my art previously was in a sense anticipating this space that I had some, you know, relative success with, in a sense sort of trying to construct this virtual environment that didn't exist yet for me. And I find it anticipatory in that respect. I actually think that, I mean, there's a lot of art that goes on in virtual environments or the use of virtual environments. I actually find that somewhat, how can I say, it collapses my art because it's so realizable in some way. You know, it stops being metaphoric because you could actually create every environment that you ever wanted to create. And for me, I'm more interested, you know, in the intersection, like we all are, I think, you know, and what excites me is that intersection of the person and the technology, which somewhat gets, you know, sort of enveloped by the technology when you're involved with something like Second Life.
Hey, Ken, I think I noticed that you're very active on Facebook. When I became a member or whatever we did, Exchange, I noticed that you were really involved. Is that still happening with you?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that there was a period of time for me where I jumped into a lot of technologies all at once. I was speaking and traveling all over, meeting a lot of people. It became a great networking tool for that situation. It's sort of reeled in a bit now, but it was because of the virtual friendships that I would make. Let's say I was in Washington, meet people, and those people are the people I'm connecting with intellectually. And so you want to keep that discourse going, that discussion going, the conversation going.
Right. That was in Washington, D.C.? Washington, D.C. or Washington?
Yeah, Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. or California or New York.
You had a life. You had established a life over there. You're not just in Ontario, and so you had to create a parallel social life. So that's how Facebook came in.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly true. My family is distributed in that way as well, and so it became a very playful tool, playful environment. I enjoyed very much. Although I do feel that something happened 6 months ago, 8 months ago, something like the luster came off it all for me.
Yeah, because, I thought that you were, I knew you 5 years ago and you were a teacher. So I'm looking at this Facebook. I said, look at this guy. He's telling these people everything he's doing, and I'm thinking you're still a teacher. But I didn't know that you were going around other parts of the country and continent and creating a whole life. When I understand that, when I know that, then I understand why you are Facebooking a lot, because you've created a lot of networks.
And certainly not telling everybody everything.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah. So you know, participating in conversations as appropriate, and understanding that you don't need to be, what's that guy's name, Anthony Weiner, right, to participate in these, you know, effectively. You don't have to show everything, right?
Right. Yeah, but, the congressman in New York.
Yeah, that's right. There was a commercial on television several years ago that involved a fella sort of sitting at his computer and his wife watching TV, and he kind of hits the return button on the keyboard, and up pops this pop-up menu that says, "You finished the internet." like you've seen it all, right? I'll send the YouTube to you. And then I can't remember what the product was whatsoever. And in a sense, you know, I sort of had an analogous experience in the last 9 months or so, which is that I feel like something that I've been involved with deeply, not only as a scholar, but as a, you know, entrepreneur, networks, social networks for, you know, professional and personal reasons, had, you know, sort of run its course.
Last spring, there was journalistic articles about a lot of people were leaving Facebook. They've had it.
Yeah, and I think the numbers have come down and stuff, you know, but I mean, a lot of people, you know, there's like 499 million people instead of 500 million or something. But I think also that, in listening to the work that you're doing, Bob, and the discussions you have with Ion and so forth, you know, sort of, I think we're moving into an anticipatory phase of some new technology that's going to change. You know, not that the internet goes away, not that all of this goes away, but that it, you know, it takes a lesser focus in our day-to-day lives.
It's not as fascinating.
Becomes part of the background, as it were.
Right, the given. So I'm thinking, let's start over again. What the heck? Don Thiel used to say this, that McLuhan got unnecessarily involved and created this partition between technology and culture. What is the issue when telephones came in? Why, and then the later technology, why are people arguing about what's real and what isn't? I think they mean something else. Isn't it just that in the suburbs, the kids were watching TV in the 50s, so the adults had to discuss it. And then the internet comes in and kids are using it, and now they're using mobile stuff. Who talks about it? Adults. And the adult language is usually not very adequate. And then McLuhan comes in to turn the whole argument about what's happening with television into an art form. I'm just wondering why we're even wondering whether this is real or not. Well, why does that come in?
It's interesting because when Facebook first came in, I was in San Jose, California. I just joined, so 2007, and at, you know, a conference party, something like that. And I think I quoted you, Bob, when I said that, you know, it sort of seemed to me like phatic, you know, communication, phatic,
yeah,
communion, that we're all in touch with people, you know, and so it's like just kind of keeping tabs on people or having that network of people in your imagination, in your consciousness, that made you feel like you were part of something. And in many cases, you were part of something. You were part of, you know, an intellectual movement or a cause or a grievance or whatever it might be. And a gentleman who I was speaking to, was speaking with at the time, said, "Well, you should see my daughter on Facebook. It's not phatic at all. It's completely emphatic, right? Like that for her, that is her life. I mean, she is ramped up on this to such a high degree that."
But it is phatic in terms of any consequence. They're just very, McLuhan's word, involved. Very involved in their phatic exchange.
Mm-hmm.
See,
that's a good point.
Yeah, the thing is, I said on an early mum that we were so disconnected that the whole internet was a nostalgia for connecting with other people, that the satellite global theater had disconnected people. It didn't create a connecting intelligence. De Kirchhoff says the internet is a connecting thing, but I think it's a panic connecting thing. And that's why people accepted phatic. It was phatic is connecting, just sort of waving. And the public space had so disappeared, everybody was panicking, so we brought in the internet to sort of pretend we could still wave at people. So that's an aspect of so-called panic fad community. But the thing I was I'm trying to figure out what the issue is, if there's other objects that come into people's immediate purview, and someone who's your friend or relative or something starts engaging that object and not paying attention to you, that's the beginning of tension. And so then the parent says, well, wait a minute, why are you doing all that? You got to go over here and do your homework or do this or take the garbage out, some suburban task. And the kid says, no, I'm involved. I'm involved in this. And then the parent says, well, don't. You got to do this. And then the argument escalates into metaphysics. Well, you're not engaged in reality. The reality is you got to take the garbage out and mow the lawn. You know, that simple tension about what focuses, what people agree that is the issues they share in the community is all that we're talking about. To bring in whether it's real or not, that's a secondary print effect, right? It's a category. But isn't the drama is, what do I put my energy into? And a bunch of other people putting their energy in over to being Facebook, should I engage that? Is that going to give me back my energy output? That's the original issue, isn't it?
Yeah, or it's, I guess you could use the word common sense, although I guess...
The common sensory involvement.
Yeah.
And that means, what do I do today? What is important? Like Ken, you have to decide whether 5 years of doing all that stuff, is there other ways I could have taken my physical body energy and put it somewhere else? Would it have led somewhere else? You don't know, so you got to assume that the chip body experience was relevant. But that's always niggling at people. Where do I put my experience, my energy, that will make me feel that I've validated myself? And new technologies confuse that.
Yeah, no, and like I say, incredibly pragmatic, you know, pragmatic than most of my colleagues in this field, you know, not accepting it wholeheartedly and doing really practical things with it, you know. And but one interesting thing struck me when I was starting with this, because I would lecture to educators and so forth and about the potential, the possibilities, you know, give them some ideas. And how can I say this? They would worry about really practical parental things, like, well, if our students go into like Second Life, won't they like have sex? Right. You know, virtual sex. And I would say things like, well, you know, I don't think we're introducing college students to sex, you know. I mean, I think they probably have a pretty good handle on that without us. And
make their icon do some bumping into each other when they've totally transgressed their human skin boundaries? Like, that's hilarious.
Yeah, let me bring in this. One night in a Monday night seminar, McLuhan said, I don't know how it came up, he just said, sex is the most important thing in life. And you say that to different people, hey, they're shocked that McLuhan would say that, because for whatever reason, but it's a truism. It really is all about sex. I mean, the parents' role is, when can the kids have sex? Are they going to have too much sex? Will they get pregnant? You know what I mean? That isn't sex the common sense, and I think many people think tactility means touch and sex, but sex being the common sense that gauges what you're doing for the community and what should be done. How much pain do you take on? How much pleasure?
Yeah, totally. Because it's also a mode of knowing as well. And
It's how you engage your energy, which is usually polarized, how much discomfort and how much comfort. What do I do to feel good? As Ion says, follow the fastest path of your joy. That's an archetypal syndrome. How am I doing? And am I feeling good enough? And you check someone out. How are they feeling? Wow, they look like they're having a good time. Maybe I should do what they're doing. It's the constant gauging of what other people appear to be enjoying or painful on the spectrum with how you're doing.
Well, I have to tell you that, you know, I would, and this is right at the beginning of this journey, but I would introduce, you know, sort of middle-aged educators to this experience, and compared to, you know, 20-year-old college students, they were much more committed to the sensual experience than the young people were. Young people are incredibly skeptical, right? Like, you know, if I'm in a virtual world, I can't text message constantly, right? It's ruining my social life, right?
Right. Whereas, and you're saying the adults were more serious about what?
no, more serious, more titillated by the experience as an erotic experience, as a connecting experience.
Yeah,
the
basically
experience.
It basically porn. I mean, porn is the driving thing for many media in the electric age. So many adults use porn, right? They get titillated. They use the internet for porn. So you're saying that the adults, they were enjoying the escape that porn gave them because they probably have committed relationships, whereas the kids are still trying to work out committed relationships, and that's more important than wasting your time in virtual space.
In a sense, I mean, I would call it, rather than porn, I would say, you know, sensual pleasure, let's say. So that could mean the experience. Remember, now I'm identifying with that avatar, so, I'm 50-year-old, college teacher, and I have a big beer belly and stuff, and I walk in here and I'm a hunk, you know, and so, you know, playing the fantasy self, as it were, you know.
Okay, so then there's issues of worth, what's it called, self-respect that make people who've aged and lost some of their charisma think, oh boy, I look different. I remember in 2001, I was in a suburban home, and there were several families had met for the summer, for the week. And all these kids are running around in this house and outside and going to the beach. There's the father of one of the families sitting in the corridor of the house, a bit away from people, and I walked by, and he was sitting on the floor, and he was looking at porn. This father with all his kids. Like, to me, it's always stuck is there's a guy addicted. He can't even socialize and pretend he's a parent and interested in the kid's summer vacation. He had to go online.
I certainly experienced from the same people who express concern about the moral upstanding of their students, a feeding frenzy of relief. You know, like look at me. I've got great hair and look at these shoes and a real fantastical kind of encompassing erotic experience as
You're saying that adults felt great because they had this better image.
Yes.
They liked their avatar.
Yeah, they liked it maybe, to a degree that was revealing about, their other concerns about their students, being introduced to morally, questionable material.
Right. So then that is the initial reason people enjoy it. They enjoy the new medium, the new technology as a pleasure thing. Okay, neat things. It's fun. Then Chase Manhattan Bank or Morgan Chase comes in and they get Facebooks. And then all the older institutions come running into the space because the economy becomes necessary in there.
Yeah, the economy is unbelievable there. I mean, as an advertising space, it's insidious. And if you made a comment about me on my bicycle, a moment later you would see an advertisement for bicycles,
yeah.
Right? It fills in where you've led, right? It's sort of you break the path, and then the ads kind of fall into place at every moment, so constantly changing mosaic of your wishes, so it's constantly reinforced.
And that's really McLuhan when he said in the 50s, electronics is as ESP. That really, it is ESP. It's there mirroring you as you engage. It's talking back to you and reinforcing what it sees that you're doing. So these are old themes about the internet. I'm just trying to figure out what this memory is. Why anybody, why do I have my terms five bodies? Chip body, TV body. Why did postmodernism go into the organs without bodies and bodies without organs? What were they doing? why did they make an issue out of it? Of what was physical? But then when you get this story where people are losing weight because they're engaging in this sitting around watching something and not doing exercise yet losing, that changes people's images of what perception is or what memory is or what is guiding them, right?
Yeah, and also of authorship, Bob, in the sense of I know a lot of people have turned to the issue of physicality because it is completely an issue of authorship, and as opposed to authoring one's own avatar in a virtual space, which somehow meshes or represents that the power and grandiosity that we have as extended beings, or are our physical bodies authored by some external deity, something beyond or outside of us?
Yeah, are you saying authored, A-U-T-H-O-R?
Author, A-U, yeah, as in
yeah, you're
authority.
Saying it's about, okay, authority is embedded in there, and awe, A-W-E.
Which is a dimension of the common sense, which is whom is the author of the common sense, or within the bounds of the common sense, what are we to give awe and authority to?
Yeah, that reminds me, another line, it may be in cliche archetype, McLuhan says, there's the need to know. There's always the community's need to know. That's like a driving appetite of gauging where I am in relation to other people, which becomes extreme symptoms of paranoia, schizophrenia, panic, hysteria. McLuhan, remember he said in his Gerald Stern interview in Hot and Cool that people are always communicating. And he meant like when they're smoking with people in a club. He was emphasizing body language, which seemed new to people. Oh, yeah, it's not just word talk. There's body language. There's other communications going on. Then McLuhan would say, yeah, and so when movies came in, people got to see nonverbal gestural communication, and it changed behavior. So he's talking about the changing of perception, but still, why make a big deal of that? People like going to movies. Now they like, having access to the internet and posting stuff. How am I, and that's the neoconservative point, right? They say, this is all exaggeration. People just got to work and live and have families, and they like to buy stuff, and they like to have new technology. They take a very practical, what McLuhan says, a Calvinist or a Puritan, or not making an issue out of technologies affecting people. They think it's just common, it's just practical. People are always the same, and they don't change. They just have new things to do, and the economy builds on that. That plain view, McLuhan called it a plain view, it's interesting to bring that in.
Well, and I think that perhaps we are now, and I don't know where you mentioned this, but the speed of the introduction of new technologies allows us to, view the environment of the previous technology at a more rapid pace. So, movies over a course of 30 or 40 years, it was intergenerational. So my parents saw movies, so I don't know, they didn't think about how they changed the way they behave. So,
right.
Sort of indoctrinated into that point of view. Whereas, if you see someone, suddenly your husband or wife is jumping into Second Life, having virtual dates and going to dance clubs, it's fairly evident there's a behavioral change, at work, and rushing back to the computer or constantly looking at the mobile device to be involved with this. I have to tell you that when I first went into Second Life, I was working with students at Harvard University, and it was the sort of where the shoe dropped for me in terms of understanding, the collaborative potential of these environments. And my wife would come into the room and say, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm in this virtual environment, Second Life. These are students from Harvard University, and I'm having a seminar with them. And she said, well, those aren't students from Harvard University. Those are kids pretending to be students from Harvard.
In other words, she couldn't believe. That's interesting. She couldn't believe that they were so accessible to you, and that therefore they're faking it.
Yeah, that's right.
And she thought
right.
And she thought the internet was a wilderness that was not policed yet. That a lot of conning could happen, right?
And that I was an easy mark, obviously.
Yeah. No, that's a really good story, because that's the 90s. That's early internet response, right? She doesn't know the detail, just knows it. So she's saying there are kids pretend, because I remember that. The whole thing was you could go on when they first talked about MUD and these things in 93, 94, when Netscape came out and people started to get the computers. Oh, boy, I can go and pretend I'm someone else. So that was the initial social impression was, oh, it's a place where I can fake it. So she thinks that everybody's faking it.
I still think she does.
And she's wondering. Yeah, and she's gauging, is my husband spending his energy properly here for other things she thinks we have to do? And he's sitting at a chair talking into a screen.
Yeah, pushing buttons, clicking things.
And laughing and having fun. And she goes, wait a minute, he's having fun beyond what I can measure. Is this legitimate fun? You know what I mean?
I think that's very true. The irony was, of course, they were from Harvard, and it introduced a whole new phase in my career. So I always, sort of say, well, it's a good thing I wasn't listening to her at the time. You know?
Right. I mean, you got new economic return, right? It became practical.
Indeed.
You did consulting. So did she ever get to see that it wasn't fake?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But her level of participation is, a skeptical person, right? And not really seen, in a sense, we share this. I was there for work, right? And there was a social component, as there is in work. But for her, it didn't hold any promise. She would rather, throw a pot or do a painting, in physical life.
Well, not in work terms. She was glad you were making money, if you were making money.
Yeah, no, she's very happy for what happened and the insights that I was able to bring to that whole field. But, and it's the same for me now, I don't spend any time experiencing those things because it served its purpose, and I do it in a different way now. But it was never an activity to idle the time away for me.
Right. So I'm thinking that I made a statement recently, someone asked about mediocology, and I say that everybody became a mediocology all over the planet in the simple definition that they became concerned about technologies. And usually they start talking about older technologies. So when Neil Postman got this mediocology program going in New York City at the university there, that's when we were reaching the point of no media. It was this seamless web or whatever the hell the internet is that Baudrillard talked about it. And so the old thing of separate medias, analog media is the term, started to be looked at. The whole thing of celebrating McLuhan and looking at old media was a rear view, that art form phase where it's obsolete so people can engage in it. You see this? Mediacology refers to old artifacts where there's no artifacts in the internet reality. It's too much of a flux. So no object.
Are the memories the artifacts?
Yeah, now you bring in that memory issue. What is that? What are they doing in mediocology? They're remembering, like Neil Postman remembers what it was like when people were literate before TV came in, and he concludes everybody's amusing themselves to death, because they're watching too much TV and not reading the books and have no memories about books. Memory is a real judgment factor here. It's really the mind or the judging. So we're definitely not, there was lots of gigs consulting to companies about media, right? Media was the buzzword in the 90s. But the actual fact was there were no more media. So what is the actual concern about the internet? Is there any problem? Yes, it's about how people spend their time. I mean, that's what education was like 500 years ago, or any literate society, right? These kids got time on their hands. Well, what do we do? I'll make them read books and test them, and maybe that'll help them. Give them something to do, right? That's the social.
Yeah, and I mean, it's completely the opposite now, if you think about it. I mean, getting insight into the contemporary college classroom is a fascinating study in its absolute uselessness as an institution, right? There's more learning going on between in the gaps between the teaching than there is in the entire sphere of the institution.
Yeah, I like to think of the way universities were in the 1560s, which I never went to university, but I saw it. I would drop in and see it. It was so serious. It was a military experience. And when you go into modern universities since the 90s, like, nobody's doing anything. It's all fake. I mean, they're not working the way one did in the literate society.
A colleague of mine taught the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey, in a class at University of Toronto last year, and the students didn't read it. And not only didn't they read it, they didn't even look it up on Wikipedia, you know, sort of get the Coles Notes version, the Crib Notes, so they could participate in the discussion, nor did they stop any participation with their own media circles or their own networks, right, through mobile devices.
Right, they're texting while in class.
They were physically there, but no other part of them was actually there. Even the intention of why am I at university paying, you know, X amount of dollars to take this class in the Odyssey and I'm not participating in anything to do with the text, you know, even an outline.
Yeah, I've talked about this in earlier MUMs. The physical body is so obsolete in relation to a lot more time spent in the chip body that students are the only reason they have universities is this is where I can go and sit in my physical body and no one will bug me while I recuperate my energies to engage back in the important chip body life once I get out of class or even halfway through the class. And the thing is that teachers have to put up with that. See, this is if a teacher came in from the 50s and looked, this is ridiculous, no discipline, nobody's forcing anything. The kids are not there at all for education. They're there for another reason, which is an effect of the chip body life.
Dating and immigration, Bob. That's the new service the university provides.
Dating and immigration?
Yeah.
Immigration.
We just provide a halfway house for people immigrating into these various countries.
Oh, you mean like new citizens, that kind of immigrant?
Yeah.
It's their way of learning the culture, of spying on it.
Yeah, and a safe delineated parameters, and it's also a way of institutions knowing that this person has been validated as a socialized individual.
Right. So I know talking to you as a teacher, you find it pretty frustrating in chemical body terms of even connecting with any student or even seeing that what you impart has any effect that one thought teachers would get out of something, right, that you're supposed to pass something on. But you have to accept the situation. There's is this a problem that it's only for dating and immigration? Who is that a problem for? Is it for the president of the university who has to go around to corporations and raise money for the university and claim he's doing something rather than just being a halfway house for bodies?
I don't think it's – I mean, I don't know if you've – you know, I know there's a lot of discussion about money and as a form and as a medium and also, you know, it's obsolescence at this point. But I don't know if you read anything recently about the sense of the academic bubble, you know, as an economy.
Andrew has been telling us about the new police state in that. So finish what you're saying, and then maybe Andrew would address that. But go ahead. Yes, it is an issue, the academic bubble.
Well, you know, just as a bubble, you know, because most of the money paid to universities for tuition is actually based on loans that are guaranteed by federal governments. So in a sense, the government is using money or banks, because they're involved as well, to prop up this, you know, educational bubble. And of course, you know, the universities continue to raise the tuition rates. As the value plummets, right, the value of the actual education.
Right. And I think, Andrew, you say that they're trying to look a busy and get more serious because it's getting less valuable, so they're going to be get more into putting their energies into faking how serious education is.
Yeah, which came in more or less exactly the same time as the World Wide Web shifted came on and made the new university. That was pretty much the moment that the university repositioned itself as this new auditable, tidy, transparent, serious body.
I think that the people who take it personally are the instructors themselves. You know, because they're giving something. They're participating in something that doesn't exist. You know, it's like the ultimate charade.
Yeah, That's why media ecology was the ultimate charade. Let's talk about media effects and ignore the fact that I can't teach you anymore. If they applied McLuhan to the present, they would see that they should not be doing their activities or be doing it for another reason. I'm just providing babysitting for these kids or help them learn English. But they distracted that by pretending they were studying the effects of media. That was the final ruse. That's what you do, Andrew. You're a con man.
Yeah, I know that, Bob. But like, I successfully brokered some long and stable romantic relationships between my students. So I'm doing okay.
Did you say you hope to develop that?
Hopefully I've brokered those connections.
You see a lot of that?
We're no longer working at the level of knowledge. We've moved up and we've repositioned ourselves temporarily around wisdom, and then we've gone further, and it's all about love now.
Yeah, you're a respectable madam in a brothel.
Yeah, yep.
It's proper protocol. It's a brothel where it's polite, and you pretend that books and other media are serious things to talk about while the eyes are looking at other goals.
Yeah, it's a form of the eugenics operation, Bob. It's totally eugenic.
Right, and of course it's, you know, a prison style environment, right? So you know what happens in prison, right? You know, like the containment, you know, creates, you know, sexual tension, right?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
The fact that I have to sit here doing nothing, listening to that person up there, which I'm not listening to, even the cinder blocks on the walls, you know, it's reminiscent of that kind of experience, it, you know, completely different experience ontologically than, you know, a person is having moments and moments in the rest of their lives. I think the idea that it's a rest point, you know, it's a time to, you know, rest up for the next chip experience, I think is incredibly astute.
Had you heard that idea before?
I hadn't heard it specifically, but I love it. I think that's just great.
Yeah, in those terms. I'm thinking McLuhan said that, you know, in the 60s, we're 100 times worse than Hitler. And then he also said that, you know, the television is more dangerous than the atomic bomb. But I was thinking that the psychic violence and the moves that people and professions had to make once the digital environment came in is a software kind of Hitler activity. I mean, a new level of discarnate violence was going on. Like the violence of the administrator of Andrews University will never define what they're doing in Andrews' terms. So that's the kind of hypocrisy. So hypocrisy got quadrupled in social life. That may be what McLuhan was seeing as so much more violence.
Yeah, if I can add to that, Bob, I think that sex violence thing is important to keep with. That where you raised earlier that McLuhan was always talking about sex, there is and libido in a sense. And sex insofar as it's a transgression of boundaries, and violence of the media is also a transgression of boundaries. So we're still circling around that same thing.
That's right. That's the pleasure pain. And he cracked when he did the forward to William Key's Subliminal Seduction. He essentially solves the mystery that, what was his name, William Brian Key or something?
Yeah. I haven't heard that.
In the forward, he solves the issue that Key is stumbling around wondering why these ad guys are doing that. It's really funny. He says, no, it's obviously the interplay between sex and violence. And the more visual abundance you have, you got to have more violent images. He brought it back to that sex-violence interplay.
I remember having that book as a kid, and I could never see the naked lady in the ice cubes.
Yeah, see? Use the media for porn.
As much as I tried to see it, you know, I mean, I was looking, but...
Yeah, he really hit on a key to how to make a bestseller. He became the key. He just said, look, I'm investigating. There's lots of porn in these images. So everybody runs out and buys a book to see the porn. Yeah, it was pretty clever. And he ends up to be a Puritan in the 80s defending the Christian view that heavy metal groups were embedding lyrics in there. You know, he became involved in a very important case. Did you know that, Andrew?
No, I didn't. So that's Wilson Brian Key. And the book is Subliminal Seduction. I think it was put out in 1973. So that's a long time ago.
Yeah, 1973. That was the year. And McLuhan, he writes a letter to Key saying, you've ruined my reputation, because Key became popular, and the salacious parts of it was identified with McLuhan because he dared to associate with Key. And Key got the idea by sitting in McLuhan's coach house. He was a student of McLuhan, a drop-in. And so Marshall writes a book for his friend, and then it goes way bigger than he realizes. And you've seen that letter, Andrew, where he says, you've ruined my reputation because I'm associated with you. And yet McLuhan had solved the problem. It was no big mystery.
I mean, really, isn't this material that's like a mechanical bride? And you know what he did is he put good pictures in it, color pictures.
Yes.
He put advertisements in it.
That's right. And so McLuhan, he says, Mr. Key, there's no mystery here. If you just, you're going to have more sex when there's more violence. He says there's no mystery in what. Of course the advertising agencies are putting this violent stuff in here because there's a lot of beautiful imagery. So you got to bounce it off with negative. He thought it was totally practical what they were doing. Of course, I talked to advertising guys. I had a relative who was a major advertiser in Toronto, and he did not. He said that was outrageous what Key was saying. He says, I made ads. I never stuck images in there. And if he was lying to me, he was pretty good at it. You know what I mean? It was a big trade secret that they actually were doing it. But he was worried about being charged. And McClure said, well, of course they do that. They have to embed stuff because the sex violence dialectic has to keep going. He's like concluding on a different level.
And taking that back to the educational system, and you know, the sitting in a classroom, right? You know, one might imagine that, you know, that students sitting there, completely bored out of their skulls, having no idea what's going on and not participating, you know, are being violated, right? It's a form of violence. It's a form of, you know, containment at the very least. And so, hence Andrew's success as a matchmaker.
You never can talk. Social life
is
necessary.
It's either that or they'll rush the teacher, right? They'll, you know, you have to be a matchmaker, otherwise the violence might be turned upon you.
That's right. I saw this lecture. I'll pretend to teach and you pretend to be a student. This professor did a lecture called that. I'll pretend to teach and you pretend to be a student. And that was in 98. Now, you got this. Social life is always adjustment and biased and not full on, quote, honest. That's the nature. When you meet two people, and Joyce makes this an archetype in Finnegan's Wake, when Mutt and Jute meet on page 16, they can be cavemen or any two people, they have to sort of juggle what they're saying to each other. And that's what McLuhan called the drama of cognition. So Andrew can't be blatant about what he's doing. He cannot teach the kids that what we're doing here is I'm a matchmaker. They wouldn't tolerate him revealing the ground. Right? And neither would the professors.
No, the whole thing would collapse. It would collapse without the drama, right? Without the act, right? It's like we're waiting for the show to begin so we can tune out, right? It reminds me of that story you told Andrew, actually, of Bob Logan and McLuhan, you know, you're going to the physics lecture and both falling asleep, right? So it started, now we can have a nap, right?
Yeah, now this is where Baudrillard comes in. He started to show the services of phoniness. It was called seduction. You see, the literate, they want obviousness so that they know what's going on so they don't get fooled and killed. That's why you demand a little stating of why we're going on this hunt and who are you going to kill, right? Because you might get killed. So the survival instinct is at the core of it. But now it's gotten so complex that Baudrillard's celebrating artifice. And so here in Croker's Data Trash, he's writing to the working people, who are hard to define who they are anymore in the information society, but he's trying to do a new Marx thing, and his concluding chapter is called The Intelligence of Artifice. So look what he says. Beyond capitalism, the 21st century witnessed the triumphant ascendancy of the virtual class as the dominant historical impulse of the next epoch. No longer the age of pan-capitalism, the virtual class will resuscitate capitalism after its death dragging the corpse of the Victorian capitalist production machine onto the world stage for one last cameo appearance before technology, in the form of the will to virtuality, finally sheds its skin to become the pure sign form that it always yearned to be. Now, here's the important thing. Croker's saying the virtuality is post-technology. The will to technology is in the analog media phase, you know, the early part of the 20th century or half, two-thirds of the 20th century. The will to virtuality kills the will to technology. So that's important to know when you read Croker, because part of media ecology is people studying the effects of technology. And yet technology is obsolete. We've moved into the will to virtuality. So I call that moving from the TV body to the chip body. So then he says, a virtual millennium of pure tech, he's describing the year 2000, a virtual millennium of pure tech, year 2000 is driven by the cold seduction of digital dreams, really a return in hypergarb of the age of Christianity, a new religious era in which the salvation myth is embodied in technical willing, where conversion fervor swirls through the air once more, and where the spasm priests take the virtual form of missionaries in the age-old quest of quick-dumping recalcitrant flesh in favor of the pleasures of the virtual entertainment complex. St. John the Baptist is on the net, and this time he's wearing a Nintendo Power Glove and cyberware scanning eyes for announcing the coming of the newest California hyper-messiah of the day. Pure tech churns personal histories into cyber dust, twisting and turning the always failed search for a stable personal identity. There's that person looking for a stable personal identity on which to hang one's hopes. But unlike the early days of Christianity, where martyrdom was the coinage of redeemed flesh, the virtual century witnesses a stripped-down eschatology. It is the sacrificial tale of victims as their own executioners. A recycled culture for the remake century glitters before us like a neon mirage on the shimmering desert landscape. A virtual sign without virtue for a millennium that opens on the screens of cyberculture as the triumph of artificial intelligence. That's what it is. That's the Android meme. But without the intelligence of artifice. Now, what a lot of complex shit going on just because the kids have access to computers. What a complex bunch of words that Croker comes up with.
That is beautiful science, post-science fiction, though, Bob. Like, I was loving that. But,
No, I agree. It's beautiful poetry. It's beautiful, well-written, and it's prophetic. This is written before people get on the Netscape. In general, that happens in 95. This comes out in 94, meaning it was written in 92, 93. As a matter of fact, a side issue. Greg Skinner looked at, when I announced last week that I'd like to know more about Michael Weinstein, the co-host of this, however you pronounce this, Weinstein. Well, Greg Skinner went on, and he's a professor at Indiana someplace. Don't have some smaller college. But you go on his the student appraisals. This guy is the greatest teacher in the history of humanity. The kids say, this guy taught me everything. He's the greatest professor. And, like, he's 65. He's probably retired in some way. And he, in his class picture, his school picture, he's there. He looks like a punk. He's got a bandana. He looks like a biker. And this biker guy had made this incredible book. I assume he wrote half of it. And he's 65 years old, runs a punk band, or plays in front of a punk band. But the students were ecstatic with how great this professor was. There was one student who said, despicable, one word, despicable was the chorus. But the intelligence of artifice, what is artifice in this situation? Lying? What is artifice?
Yeah, exactly, Bob, exactly.
So
anyway, Ken's just sent me a little back channel message. Ken, you've got to go kind of soon, so do you want to
yeah, I have to duck out, I'm afraid.
Okay, yeah, Ken, yeah, well, Ken, before you go, let's have Marsh McLuhan talk to us. Now, Ion's here. We can address Ion as McLuhan. So what would you
believe,
like to ask McLuhan?
Has to go probably means has to go. We can
Give him 30 seconds.
I could probably spare a few, another moment for Marshall McLuhan.
Ask Marshall, and I don't know, Ken, if you get Ion or Marshall, but address Marshall. What do you want to know?
Marshall, I'm doing a media fast with my family on Sunday, but I need to read the New York Times via my Kindle. Is that my chip body still, or am I reading a newspaper just in a different format?
You are reading the black and white and red all over.
So it doesn't matter that it's an electronic form.
Chip body is chip body, just as your avatar would tell you if you asked it.
So I'm cheating.
Well, cheating is relative based on the gibberish I've gone through so far tonight.
Okay, ask him about something we like about memory or something, Ken, about what we were talking about.
Marshall, in my experience in the virtual environments, we have witnessed that people remember these virtual reality experiences as if they had happened to them.
You're confusing veracity with tenacity. And if you keep going, you're going to agree with our entire phallus.
Okay, so memory is on the side of veracity or tenacity?
Veracity, validating tenacity, or a
right.
tenacious movement regarding a predisposed outcome that's not yet achieved, and there's the problem.
In the 70s, McLuhan said that people were adopting forgetfulness on purpose as an anti-environment to the fact that data banks knew more.
And everything you developed so far is based on a legitimized memory.
Yeah, yeah.
And
isn't that
as it was portrayed?
Now, did that come in with the book?
No.
What did that come in with?
The abject conductivity of the written in stone printed word.
That's well, I said the book.
That's before the book, though.
Oh, the stone, the clay tablet.
Yeah.
The clay tablets, developed the drive to remember and valid true memories?
It's nebulous. It doesn't mean anything. Say something that's meaningful.
Yeah, what was the word you said? You said something about, you know, a minute ago. You called it the validation, the verification, the tenaciousness. You said that, but there was something about the certified memory, right?
Yes, yes.
So that comes in with the clay tablet.
Well, that's what you go back to verify a predisposed memory. That's the whole avatar business that Ken pretty well laid out, which is fine.
Right.
Is it, and Ion says it best, is it live or is it Memorex? Well, if you can't tell the difference, who cares? It is.
And they didn't worry about it before the clay tablet.
Well, but then it became a capacitation. See, your studious students are finding it prolifically absurd to be engaged in a position where everything you're saying they can already know, and they don't even have to have the cliff notes to pass your class.
Yeah. Well, in their social life, what do they
there
come up?
There is no social life.
Okay.
Experience.
Okay, in their experience with others of their age group, and they
there
feel they're
no age group.
Oh yeah. Okay. What do they think is worth communicating about? Since they could know anything someone could tell them, including their friends, why do they talk to each other?
Validating my last orgasm for my next orgasm.
That's the common. You agree with this? Is where you're saying sex is the most important thing, and the common sense
hadn't changed.
Thank
Andrew.
You all, gentlemen. We'll be in touch soon. I hope to join you again. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, come back, Ken.
Marshall.
That was very good.
Thank
a very
you,
good
Bob
contribution.
Cheers,
but,
Ken.
Nice
great
to speak
have
to you,
here.
Bob.
Yeah.
And we look forward to talking about your art further and additional things. So, cheers.
Absolutely. More ideas on the horizon. I look forward to the next time we can all get together. All the
okay.
best.
Okay, Ken. Thanks a lot. So, Andrew, it's me and you, Mutt and Jute, and the Holy Spirit. Do you have any questions for McLuhan?
No, I have no existing questions for McLuhan at this juncture. I'm quite happy
to push on
in my own way.
Yeah, McLuhan, why does Andrew have no questions for you?
Well, we would point out a certain degree of lunacy. But then we'd have to have a hypothesis in order to engage that position, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you are, then you definitely know about lunacy, because I read your diary and you marked in every full moon since the age of about 20 to when you're 60. So, McLuhan was certainly a man who I identified with the lunatics.
It's right in his name, McLuhanacy. Marshall, why were you noting the full moon? Where did you learn a significance to that?
The span of the abject disposition of the passing of what you call a cycle, the capacitation. We did it in the Playboy interview. You've read that.
Yeah.
The details of the bill of particulars that allow a shift to make something that is not important on a, quote, what you say, full moon, of great importance. And so goes the lesson.
So the moon was the first figure or medium you were watching the effects of.
That's the Galileo construct, yes.
Yeah. No, it's interesting.
Well, okay, so like Galileo is great, because like Galileo is real significant to McLuhan, huh? Because Galileo's one of his most significant works is a dialogue between two world
systems.
Are we
trapped in third person?
Who's we?
Are you objecting to the way Andrew addressed you in some way?
Well, if we're third person, we'll speak to you in third person, but we are not.
Okay, no, this is really good. I unsuckered Andrew because Andrew's on to Galileo, and you just got Andrew all involved, man, by saying those words.
Yeah, well, words, they're pretty exciting. They're great.
Okay, go ahead. What were you leading to?
Well, Galileo, he offered his most significant treaty, wasn't it? It was a dialogue between two world systems and McLuhan and setting up
world systems. Get it right.
Well,
five, did you say?
By.
By world. B-Y?
Yeah.
Oh, B-I.
That are significantly intertwined, yes.
You mean each world system has two? Because there's two of everything.
Well, yes, but that's not the point. The point that Galileo was construct was based upon this world had to be against another world, or you'd never know or rectify the actual spinning or a polarity or the gravitational pull that is as an ellipse rather than a perfect circle.
Oh, very good. So the bi world is no object in isolation.
Referring to a title. Like, I'm actually referring to a specific title of a book. The Dialogo sopra e giù, I think, Massimi Sistema del Mondo, the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems. And so, which is, I guess, similar in a sense to what McLuhan followed up when he was looking at culture and technology. He's pointing at the one thing through the two.
The bi-ness of the interaction between those systems, precisely.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah, he said objects are unobservable, you know, as isolated things. They're only knowable.
Until they are, and then they are.
Right, and they're only known through relationships between objects. So,
well, that's what your ion speaks about, but the distance between an is and an arness.
Right, so what is the
construct.
What was happening before Galileo that he needed to point out this fact about bi-worlds? Oh, what were they missing before?
They were still under the demise that the world was flat.
Oh, okay. And so you can tend to think the world's round because bi-ness is necessary. So there has to be...
Without bi-ness, without death, there's no life.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So what was the disservice of what Galileo came up with, what he wrote, what he concluded?
The battle between the actual high mass within the realm that he was trying to validate.
The battle of the high mass, what, the Catholic ritual?
Catholicism.
Yeah, what's the battle in the high mass?
Well, the whole battle is within the Illuminati, Bob.
Oh, okay, but So that would be the way a society was organized, by making so much preciousness around the mass.
Disorganized, yes.
Yeah, disorganized, on the behalf of a few.
Well, obviously, yes.
So the high mass, you mentioned that, that created hierarchy. It was the ultimate action,
no,
the ultimate object.
You're missing the point. The point is not about, it would be more about validating acidity than it would be the construct that you're trying to portray. If you gauged every aspect of knowing based on is it acid or is it alkaline, then there'd be no conversation. It'd be simple. But because you're making a to-do about the to-do, then everything comes into how it applies. Well, the application has nothing, absolutely nothing, to do with what you've had conversation with regarding so far. What you're trying to do is you're trying to say, okay, these are some interesting constructs, and everything has changed, blah, blah, blah. Everything has shifted, blah, blah, blah. Everything's okay, blah, blah, blah. Everything's not, blah, blah, blah. But you're missing the point of the acid, alkaline shift. Or a very simple construct, or excellently spoken, would be a simple litmus test of what you call education in that whole process.
So you're saying you were looking at change, trying to get to the basics, to simplify it, to
simplify it, then the memory is all but foolish.
Gone.
Right.
So you were into a simplifying process.
What do you think?
Now, that's interesting, Andrew, because we've been complaining about how McLuhan's writings are too simple for the 80s.
Well, but yet you still didn't get it. apparently wasn't that simple.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting. That's a good point.
It does have services in that sense. If you're looking then, if part, and this is just guessing here, is part of McLuhan's writings is to
if you live a little while, you'll realize there's not that past, present, future aspect.
Yeah, I know what he's suggesting to, Andrew. You don't say McLuhan's writings. Say part of his writings. He's here. that's what he was objecting to. You time on McLuhan as if he's a third person. So interpret his writings again. What were you saying, Andrew?
The effect, one of the effects of McLuhan's writing, in a sense...
No, his writing. Your writing. Address him.
No. That's... I'll just keep talking about McLuhan.
There's the fallacy effect 101. We're glad you're in the educational process.
You're a good teacher. You're hypocritically ignoring the immediate obviousness and referring to some abstract thing.
That's like this tobacco that we smoke, McLuhan enjoyed.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I can celebrate my own hypocrisy.
Bless you.
the intelligence of artifice, Andrew.
The point, gentlemen, was the unshackling from memory. The effect that McLuhan's works bring about is, in a sense, a mode of being in the present, going outside of oneself into another space that is not reliant or dependent on being bogged down in the slippery slope of memory.
How's that, McLuhan? What do you say?
Is there a question?
Yeah, is there a question, Andrew?
No, this is a statement.
Oh.
Okay.
It's ridiculous. So any way you want to do that.
Are you saying his statement had too many words, too many clauses?
Well, no, it was ridiculous. He doesn't even know what he said. So how can we address it?
Okay, Andrew, step up to the plate again.
Back it up. You started off with an okay position. Your position was relatively clear until you added all. You got dropped into the adverb. You got dropped into the adverb gallery, and you just got lost, got drunk on the Thompson cheap wine at the coach house. So simplify that just a little bit, and come on and get to some point that's actually achievable. You're back in the days. You're back in the days of dazzling with diamonds or baffling them with bullshit. But you haven't said anything yet. You've made a statement, but it's most excellent.
Most excellent. All right, did you get the Thompson reference? You know, Thompson would serve the wine, remember? He'd run out and get the wine at the Cocho's for McLuhan.
Yes, he's apparently sweet. This would go much better if you were a bit liquored up.
it's highly possible.
Okay, Andrew, you were emphasizing
Andrew,
memory.
Andrew, ask it again. Ask it again and be clear. And if you get stumbled over the big words, you can pause. We'll help you.
I appreciate your civility and politeness at that point. But no, it wasn't a question. It was a simple statement referring to one of the effects.
It wasn't simple. It was nonsensical.
Writing.
So say one that is.
Yeah, you focus. You end it with memory. But begin again. What's the issue with memory, Andrew, that you were saying?
In relation to, like, what I was saying was reflecting on one of the effects of McLuhan's works was, or at least some of the more simpler text, is that he unshackles the reader from memory, and he places us in a position where we can encounter...
No, it is not that way. It's not that way at all. It's not that way at all. Without memory, there is no statement to have a regard to the position.
I didn't say without memory, but it's...
Without memory, there's no position to have a construct...
Well, he didn't say without memory. He said it shifted memory. Or what did you say,
well,
Andrew?
Well, the shifting of memory is not the point at all. You must validate your memorable...
Of course it is. It's one of the canons of rhetoric. Totally, McLuhan's working on at the level of memory.
Well, yeah, what aspects of memory, Marshall? You wrote about the memory theater, Marshall. What were you referring to?
The memoria.
Memoria. Okay, go ahead, Aya. Marshall.
The specific pinpoint of the application of a memorial or memory that you would use to guise the mystery landscape. Those are your words, Bob. But to even gauge what the meme is and what the message is, to calculate where the medium that applies to your understanding, overlaying, or position. It's where you gauge where you are from or to.
So, Ion, so memory is as important as sex?
More, because without memory, you wouldn't know how to get it again.
Very good. That's very interesting. So memory is the original medium or technology?
The application of it, but that you're talking about practicality, so yes.
And is memory a nothing place, what we call tactility?
It's
in
only
the
a nothing until it is, and then it's
right.
Nothing.
It is, and it's hard to pin it down, like trying to find the mind.
It is not hard to pin down once you know.
Right, right. Until you know... That is the essential mystery you've got your labyrinth of your mind in.
Well, but once your avatar has a big dick, then you know it does, don't you?
Okay. So someone who is...
Now, don't let that go. You can't let that go. What do you do? You can't let that go.
I'll let Andrew handle that one.
Well, back it up and take it from that point.
You know, I'm not going to handle Ion's big dick. You know,
I mean, Ion. This is not Ion. This is Marshall.
Now you're talking about an avatared world
that
takes on a completely new construct that you can live in, you can engage, the medium is the message. Well, now the message then has a meaningful interaction in a concourse or a construct that allows you to be, do, or have your pleasure. And you can adjust at will within the confines. It is confining, isn't it?
Yeah.
Your avatar that allows you to try on a new set of the emperor's new clothes.
Right.
good McLuhan choice there. So as we know, as we remember him, McLuhan. So you're addressing what we were talking about earlier, the role of memory and how a new technology, like the moon, changes the context for the memory,
construct.
Or a new application.
Construct, not the, construct.
Context. It changes memory itself.
Well, it validates it. And once a memory is validated, then it becomes a knowing. And once it's known, then you can't unknow it. Well, once it's now that you have no ability or capacity to unknow it, then that's the new medium that you are forced to be confined within.
Yeah. So then that looks for a release?
It doesn't look for it. It will
evoke a release.
Evoke a complete release.
And that's otherwise, the principle that you pointed out. The evolution of technology was based on counter pressures.
Well, of course.
You get that, Andrew?
Then if you ever, if you bother to engage that for a bit, you'll get a complete understanding of what the global village was even about.
That's the Canadian accent for those who don't know, about. So do you see what he's getting at, Andrew?
I was just contemplating, how this earlier discussion of conscious mediumship then relates to memories and the multiplicity of memories and memory systems, and how each mode of common sense has its own mode of memory as well.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's a very interesting position. You're talking about common sense, one known by all.
Yeah.
Common
senses. Okay, so you're knowing what a beast would know, and also known as horse sense. Yes?
Yeah. No, maybe not doing well. It's just what everybody shares as an equal environment, or is an environment
that. That's the whole point. That's the very environment that's shifting.
Right.
So you're basing your whole premise on something that can't be attached or applied, and then you're asking for words regarding the position, and the very position itself is like sinking sand. You're slipping away even now, and then wanting to validate that point to a point, and you can't get there from there.
Okay, now apply to watching the moon. That you did when you were young.
It's ever changing. It's ever shifting. You have to gauge to where it is. Now, you've got an idea of its pathway. Well, Andrew likes pathogens, so it might have an effect of a pathogen, but yet you still have to verify that point, okay? The actual geographic location or where in the horizon it lays, the actual position that it is in respect to you from where it was previously and where it would be cosmically nextly.
Right. So does the sun changes in our perspective slower than the moon? So the moon is the guide to the factor of change in experience.
It's the gauge.
It's the gauge, more than the sun.
Certainly.
So isn't that interesting, Andrew? You, Marshall, called Northrop Frye the sun of literary criticism, S-U-N, and you were the moon, because you called yourself Moonchild in your notes to Finnegan's Wake on page 254.
Most certainly.
Interesting. The moon is the guide to more of the shifting, the more to the ground.
But Wyndham didn't see it that way, but of course, that's logical.
What way did he see it? He saw the sun is more important.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the day, the light, the eye, the constancy, or the more reliable.
Well, Corinne was always cross with that anyway.
She did Corinne read Lewis's books?
Well, bits of it until she threw them in the fireplace.
Now, did she, you say she was cross with what she heard Wyndham Lewis say?
Well, of course, because it was not based on anything. Our work is.
Yeah. And this would be what her feeling was when in 44 when they were in St. Louis and she had to put up with his Wyndham Lewis's presence. That's her knowing of Lewis because he was gone after that.
Of course.
And Corinne saw that she and Marshall were involved with the work back then.
They had a point to make in public.
Well, but see, the point is there was no point. That's the point. The point was there was no point. Well, if there's no point, then the veracity of the position for the medium being the message validates the pointless point.
Right, whereas Lewis was trying to make a point.
Lewis was trying to validate the position that
right,
was
now,
changing and shifting. And you can't get there. That's what you call, Bob, rear view mirroring it.
Yes.
See, there's no room for the landscape to shift. Now, you use the word Andrew meme like you know what the hell you're talking about. You don't. But
you mean Android meme? You said Andrew meme.
Well, there you go. But the Android, what you talk about is the Android meme. It's not Android at all.
True.
But yet you use that, people hear it, and they make a mark regarding that they think you know what you're speaking about. You know you don't. And then if they ever called you down on it, you would know.
I'd gladly admit it.
Well, exactly. And that's the whole position or the difference. Now, Andrew, we'll be soft with you. The difference between Wyndham Lewis and our work.
Yeah. So did Corinne come... I understood she was a budding actress. Did she come with an awareness of the, quote, no point when she met you?
Well, she eased up on the process just because we provided enough. It was more the glamour side of application that was intriguing.
And to her?
Yes, and we could hold her attention in the world that we were working within. Now, it wasn't as grandiose as she'd hoped, but it would do.
Yeah, because Marshall he treated his work at the university like a theater, and so there was a showbiz aspect that she'd see as like...
Absolutely, it is a theater, only a theater. It was only a theatrical application that had any resonance within the meme at question.
All right, when in 39, when you said to her, come with me to Cambridge or forget it, and Corinne goes home or starts to pack to go home and then switches and decides to stay with Marshall, and then they run around for a day or so getting quickly married, what was how did you perceive what Corinne, why did she change her mind?
The chase was on. The only way you get the attention within this construct was to turn her head by you will miss more by not going than you will enjoy by going.
Right. Why did she she makes the move to leave and starts to pack. What struck her? Did she ever tell you that made her, oh no, I'm going to stay. This will be more fun.
Matters of the heart are the heart of the matter is the matter of the heart.
I mean, it's something you can't speak to other than that statement.
That's enough.
Oh, she loved it. So she made the gesture of leaving, and then that made her feel, make her know that she loved him.
And then once that became the place, then there was no other place she'd prefer to be rather than with me.
But when they met in Pasadena, what? When you met Corinne in Pasadena, what was Corinne, well, maybe Corinne can even speak here if Corinne can come in. What was Corinne intrigued with? She says publicly that he was the oddest bird she ever saw. But
the incredulity of my own positional educated place.
This is Corinne talking.
I questioned the very knowing that Marshall believed in.
So you had a confidence, and you heard how he presented himself and what he said, and then you questioned him.
Certainly.
And then he responded well to that, and that's what you fell in love with?
Indeed, because the answer was, if the world is a stage, welcome to my world.
Right, because she's on her way to go to the stage, and then she found out there was another level of stage that Marshall applied.
Very good.
Oh, okay. That's interesting, Andrew, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay,
well,
so...
Thank
all
you.
All right.
There's many epistles that will help you, Andrew.
many early letters.
Mm-hmm.
Why did Corinne, did you have a problem with Marshall's devotion with his mother? I think you came to study under the mother, so you already were impressed with Marshall's mother.
Well, it was a force to be reckoned with. You couldn't obfuscate her, because she was, whether you, if you made Marshall choose, you were out of luck.
He'd go with the mother.
Absolutely.
So, did you, Corinne, understand quite early there was some similarity between the mother and Marshall in the way they looked at the stage?
The connection, yes.
So did Marshall's mother teach you a lot, you know, through the 40s and 50s before she... Couldn't stand her. Because she was too intense?
Well, at any moment your marriage was in peril or question if you were cross against her.
The terrible mother-in-law syndrome.
And that's all right, because she knew, as faithful as Marshall was to her, sooner or later, Marshall would be that faithful to me.
Oh, okay. Very interesting.
So it became an interplay.
Now, when I talked to Marshall through the Evergreens, the Evergreens said, I don't know if Marshall said, that Corinne was an incredible, important, stabilizing influence in the early years when she did the dictation and typing. Is that, do you agree with that, Corinne? Did you know that you were a foundation for Marshall in his work?
Thank you. We were proper.
So you were proper, you mean you knew it, but you didn't make a point out of it.
Well, think about it just a second. Sit down and take stenography with Marshall McLuhan, and you'll get put through the paces.
Mm. Because you don't expect, it's a task to hear what he's saying because it's so new.
His syntax was ridiculous. He didn't even know.
Was it because he was an oral person from the prairies? That's the way
only.
That's all he was. What influence, what idea, Marshall,
the math.
Yeah, I was going to say, what kind of aspect did Corinne contribute? You're saying the math.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because that made it the only cohesive position in his world that actually had something to base itself upon. So without the math, all is lost. He became the construct would be no more than a charlatan.
Oh, are you saying M-A-S-S or M-A-T-H?
M-A-S-S.
Oh, okay, the mass. So the mass was the anchoring point, and she and Corinne, you pointed that out to Marshall?
Absolutely.
Hmm.
Had no idea to actually go every day, but that was the point.
You didn't think that effect would happen to Marshall? Right, but you're saying that what he's talking about, the medium is a message and all that, it's concrete and a great way to explain the mass.
No, it's just the opposite. The work was puffery. The mass was consistent. Without the mass, the puffery had no place to land.
Right. Now, is the mass, did Marshall regard regard the church's doctrine about the mass relevant, or he had what the church might consider an eccentric view of the mass?
That's the whole position. It got too much sugar for a dime after a second.
You mean Marshall's interpretation was that?
Most
too much.
Absolutely. It was too far. It was too... Now, what you'd use in words today, now that's not those words, but today, those words, he's so far to the right that it offends the left.
And that's the way he was in relation to the mass. His definition in the church, they would see him as too far to the right.
Correct.
Metaphorically. So did he? He never talked about it.
That's right, because you could never apply, because everything that the mass that he believed in, that he tied himself to, was only undone by what he did the rest of the day.
Yeah. So
so the mass was, so Corinne was the sun, which was, she pointed to the mass, was the sun, but he being a moon lunatic countered what the sun was pointing out, even though it was his anchor.
Well, he used that to gauge for this whole media ecology.
He used the moon or the sun?
The moon.
Right.
Well, there's like a, well, if I'm talking to Marsha, then I don't need to talk about the document that I'm looking at. There's an extended article that McLuhan wrote looking at representations of Christ, the Virgin Mary, and all of Christian truths in relation to how they find expression in a variety of pagan cultures and stuff. And he, there's a section in there where he actually contrasts the day, the sun, the New Testament, and life representations against the night, moon, Old Testament, death associations, as per
You mean the Gospels?
Yeah, and also in the paintings, windows, all of those variety of visual representations. So the suggestion there, if he's treating that in the same way that he treats all the other dichotomies, although he's maybe has sympathies with the lunatic moon poetic side, he's probably going to play the both, right?
Well, of course, because, see, without the moon...
I just need to know, did you say play them both? Is that what you said, Andrew?
Yes, like interface them to...
Yeah.
Always. Otherwise, there's no... You have no place to gauge lightness from the what you call upper quadrants within the truths held within the Gospels. Until those become real, you have no place to gauge that a Christ-centered mass even applies.
You're saying you don't have any... Okay, so you're saying you don't commit to one or the other... Leading to what you just said.
Until you do, none apply. So that's the point.
Right, until you commit to one another, none apply. So none. So that's the pointless, or that's the none. That's the ongoing awareness of process, as Marshall defined.
Well,
you defined.
What you call media ecology.
That's the awareness of process.
Otherwise, you have no place. You have no ground. You have no ground. The Sermon on the Mount has no place to lay. Otherwise.
Right, so the sacred image for media ecology is the moon.
Matthew 5, Andrew, in case you're lost.
Is it the whole chapter, Matthew 5?
Starting at Matthew 5, that's the Sermon on the Mount.
Oh, okay. What is the sun then? What does the sun represent? That's the mass. The mass is
that
the sun.
That's the contrast that validates the Gospels.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, now get this. Now you don't drop the ball here. You've got a run going on here. Otherwise, you could never validate a Judas.
To validate him.
Yeah.
Because you required his role.
Well, if Judas wasn't validated, then there's no crucifixion.
That's right. That's right. Now, who is Judas in your career, Marshall? Metaphorically.
You mean from the coach house?
Yeah, the coach house in your career. Is it Ted Carpenter? Is it Barrington Nevitt? Is it Derek DeKirchhoff? Is it me? Who is a Judas in terms of your public work, your public image?
Would have to be Lyndon LaRouche.
Who you didn't know.
If there was one, it must be Lyndon LaRouche.
Yeah, what he acts out, because he's on the surface, he's a dialectician.
And yeah.
But you're not limited to being just a grammarian. Are you a grammarian, rhetorician, or a dialectician?
Yeah, not at all. Grammarians are put in a box based on the syntax that's being portrayed.
And what about the rhetorician?
Well, the rhetorician is what validates the syntax.
Right. What's the dialectician then?
One that knows the difference.
All right, so that's you. So you're a dialectician at this moment.
Well, but now look at the bigger picture. You've got the world, the landscape right before your very feet, even now, is shifting and changing.
Yeah.
Well, as in our world, it was shifting and changing as well. We were a quote, big deal and didn't even know we were a big deal.
Meaning your work, your
of
writing.
Course.
Yeah. Didn't even know how apt it was.
Correct.
Well, did you ever catch up to that and realize it was apt?
Well, what you say, what is it you say, your time will tell.
Hmm. So the celebration of centenary, still the worth of that, the memory of you is, in your mind, not conclusive. The jury's still out about your work.
We can't even convince our own children to agree with the party, so that's logical.
Yeah, okay. But you were not concerned about that. You were working, what were you working out? In your writing, in your thinking, in your perception.
The abstract to consider between what is and what reality unfolds.
Right. Now, Corinne.
If you could just get the abstract, if you could just get the difference between it, it helps, it opens, you have a completely new point of view. You have a new, then you don't have to get the high horse of running around telling everybody what you know. You can just know what you know, apply that into the landscape that you're engaged in now, and then you can be the king of the global village.
Okay, so that seemed to be what Alan Watts and many other cultural figures, counterculture figures in the 60s thought they were doing that, but you found that their work was too simple in doing
it. It never reached orgasm, as it were.
And yours did?
So far.
So far it reached orgasm, Andrew.
Yep, now I'm following.
So, Andrew, come up with some question or statement.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether we should keep going on this one, or whether we're going to go for the 2 hours one, or we're going to push on through. How are we going to play it?
No, I don't want to go too long. How long have we gone?
We're just on the 2 hour mark now.
Okay, no, let's end. I really appreciate what I think that was very good, what Marshall and Quinn contributed.
It opened up some new things, for sure.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Marshall and Corinne and Ion.
You are welcome.
Thank you, Ion. Much appreciated. Excellent.
And he goes away. So then, Andrew, I will go up there.
Do you want to push, pull, stop on the tape?
Yeah, I'll go up. I got to turn off the speakerphone, which is recording the backup, and then I can activate the phone. Here we go. Oh, I think Carolyn's still on. You got to turn off, Carolyn. Okay.
Now, as we were saying,
hold it. This is part two of October 6th, copyright 2011, New Grand View Incorporated, all rights reserved. And we have Ian and Ken Hudson here. Go ahead, Ian.
As we were saying, as we continue on here, we are absolutely enthralled and delighted with this avatar position that you sort of played with, tapped into, and develop it a bit, the outcomes. And we'll answer your questions. We'll give you a break and kind of ease into it. But we're on this like we're as hot as a $2 pistol, and that's why you came back.
I had a previous engagement that I couldn't break, and so this is all a bit of a fit-in for me, so I'm glad to be back, and I'm glad we can just pick it up. And I look forward to hearing the part I missed on the podcast. But
it's not very meaningful.
For me,
it's not very meaningful. You'll be all right.
So avatar, as you probably know, comes from the Sanskrit word incarnation, right?
Well, we...
And
we, yes,
so,
we're, no, please. Don't edumacate us. We know. That's the difference with us, is we kind
of
know.
I was talking to the masses, of course.
Well, bless them. That's not the point. The point of this engagement is to bring them to a place where they can make a new decision. And the new decision is this wonderful chip body aspect or tapering, well, a bit of an inception, if that's to coin a word. A bit of an inception allows you a new place, or you have developed or found a new application, which is outside of what academia, Harvard-wise or otherwise, would even necessarily embrace. However, you found an outcome that is, to say the least, interesting, yes?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, how can I, to start it off, I mean, it's the power of that I, the individual, the identity.
You mean the eye of Horus.
Certainly, the eye of Horus works. And so isn't it the ultimate put-on, right? It's the graphic representation of the chip body, of the chip I, of
graphic
the chip
as
identity.
In graphic, we're going to interrupt you, so just get used to that now.
Graphical.
As an edumacation specialist, you're not accustomed to that, but welcome to our world. You mean that it's chartable, graphable, pinpointable, that can have frequency waves attached to it and drawn sine, cosine waves drawn from it? Is that the constructs that you are laying out here?
That wasn't exactly what I meant. What I meant was, as in terms of graphical representation, in terms of virtual space, virtual context, and so forth. But
well,
now
what
that
you
say that, if I know where,
no
if
virtual,
I know where,
there is no virtual space. They've merged. That's the point.
Yes,
they're
well,
not
and
separated
so here,
any longer.
So now I find myself in a specific space in the sense that you use the term graphical, pinpointed, a psychic construct, a place. I'm
then of
in
course
a place.
Our question is how
there
can
is,
you tell? How, and then our question then becomes, how can you define the place where you are if you don't know where you're from?
Well, feel free to interrupt me now.
Boy, this I went stone cold silent. No. We aren't poking. We're just making the point that until you're able to
yes.
physically graph an exact geographical, latitudinal, longitudinal position, it sometimes becomes very difficult to gauge precisely within this landscape, especially in the avatar world, because when you come to the chip body, you in our house now. We can play.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
just to give that a bit of a background, we're saying, as an avatar, if you don't know where you are, precisely how do you validate where you've been or where you land? And then you say, oh, but Ion, it's all about the interaction. And we say, fine, that's fine. We don't have a problem with that. The interaction then becomes fresh and new, and you can be, do, or have anything you'd like to be, do, or have as an avatar. But see, our world is a little different than that, because in our world, there is more validation in human physical than there is in the avatared, pardon the tense, representation. Because within the representation, that's the visual bias that you include in the position that your wife had issue with already. It's like, this bunch of damn woo-woo. What are you talking about? This can't be, but yet it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason it is because your visual bias allowed a position that you could draw from to validate within a memory. Memory, we say, never mind. That's what we say. We say never mind. But then you start gauging those memories as aspects that affect your knowingness. Well, now, if memory is known or knowing, That's a very different conversation. We'd ask you now, precisely, Ken, do you know where your car keys are?
Yes.
Well, if you know, then you don't have to remember.
Do.
If you know, memory has nothing to do with it. It's only when you go pining for your car keys that remembering becomes in question, you see.
So this is the eros, right? The
more
the
than you know. More than you know.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous. Now.
What do you say about memory? Memory is very what?
You're on mute, Bob.
What did you say, that last sentence about memory? Memory is very important, or what did you just say?
Us or Ken?
No, you. And then what did he say, Ken? What was his closing statement there?
Sorry, I don't remember it precisely.
He said,
but the idea being...
He said memory is very something, or memory is key.
Euros. So the point is, this is the point. If you have to remember, if you can't remember, then you don't know. That's the whole point of this conversation. Mm-hmm. But if you know, then you know. Memory has no veracity affecting any vicissitudes or platitudes that you're considering. If you know.
It's still you having the experience, no matter what the medium may be.
Congratulations. However, if it's known, it is. If it's not, then it may be not remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
so,
what we're talking
about. Right, and also the extension of desire, of eros, into that space
desire.
Of longing.
Oh, longing, Bob.
The bringing
Bob,
back.
This is delicious. So the essence, okay, good. Now you're on. So describe for us the essence of desire.
Is a retrieval.
No.
But
now wait a minute.
Wait
a minute. Now you ain't getting off that easy. Oh no. Hell no. That's right. If it's a retrieval, it's retrieving to
memory.
To a degree. See, you can't retrieve a memory if you don't have. If you can't remember, you can't retrieve a memory. No, we're talking
so
about
is it beyond memory then? Is the longing
for
the unknown?
Well, it's not a longing, because if you're longing for something, you don't have it. No, we're talking about known and halved, past tense.
So could one say that the experience of the avatar, in a sense, places you back in the thing that you don't have? By having whatever you want, you're then that's the anti-environment to your own.
Well, in sometimes
that,
it's
I don't know what we're not defining longing as something that's missing, right?
Well, we are
something
because if you're longing for it, if you had it, you wouldn't long for it. I want $100 million. Well, if you had $100 million, you wouldn't long for it. But that's okay. If the avatar allows you to try it on, the emperor's new clothes, if it allows you to try it on and you feel it intrinsically, you can then see how it fits. Okay?
Yes, I agree with you completely. It's a rehearsal in some sense.
Well, but every creation is, regardless whether it's an avatared experience or not. Every creation.
It's aspirational.
Creation. Well, aspiration is just drowning in your own vomit. If you aspirate, you're done. So we don't like aspirational. Choose another word. Well, if you aspirate, you're drowning in your own vomit. So we don't like that. So choose something else. Get your thesaurus. You may need it.
Yeah, I'm there.
Do. And it's all right. It's all right. It's all right. Because we're being easy because we are delighted. You can't know how non-physical had to withhold to keep each little derivative that you were laying out. You even brought it back into your family household, into your wife, into your family, into how it applies, into the whole dimensional, well, some may call it transcendental position that you've engaged, that those even around and close to you, well, let's just be plain, the ones you sleep with didn't get it. So how do you know you got it? You see?
I likened it to, my analogy was always that I could explain to you what chocolate tastes like, but until
then
you actually
it.
Taste
then do it,
you,
do
you
it.
Won't
do
actually
it.
Know what it is.
No. Describe it. That's good.
Right.
That's what Marshall
right.
was all about, trying to get you to the place where you could question. Marshall McLuhan only brought you to the construct that you could question your position of what chocolate tastes like. Because mm-hmm. Marshall would tell you very quickly that you don't taste chocolate. Chocolate tastes you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you
an experience
can't
that
accurately
over
describe.
You
can that's why no one else can get your description, your adjectives or superlatives that you would engage regarding a descriptive position of chocolate or cacao, because you can't, because you don't taste chocolate. Chocolate tastes you. So if chocolate tastes you, then the only way you could ever describe cacao that you engage with, sweetened or otherwise, or a percentage of cacao that's bitter, or how the sweetness or the milk chocolate or on and on and on and on, you cannot. Mm-hmm. That's why you are not able to accurately convey to another human creator what cacao tastes like, because you don't taste chocolate. Chocolate tastes you. Now, if you went from the syntheses that, well, I don't know what chocolate tastes like, but I can tell you what chocolate tastes, then you could accurately convey the acumen regarding the experience of cacao.
In other words, which senses it stimulated in me personally and which emotions I associated with those stimuli.
Other
in
human
other words,
creators,
my gestalt
other,
of chocolate.
Other human creators then could say, oh, exactly. I know exactly what
mm-hmm.
you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Bam.
Mm-hmm. So, okay,
that's all
so
Marshall
let me jump off.
That's all Marshall was trying to say is you fucked this thing up and you don't know which end is up and now you're trying to validate up from down.
I speak about this a lot, and so I have, you know, a way I speak about it, which is a habit, and also, you know, in not expansive terms. Okay, so let's talk about it from your point of view. And we've had an experience before together, actually, in the
yes.
first melting titanium.
Yes.
I am, or maybe the second one, I am the pistachio ice cream.
Yes. Of course.
But it was mint chocolate chip. So it was close. It was green with stuff in it, right? So,
of course.
Okay. When I'm an avatar.
Chocolate mint chip, yes.
That's right, yes. My favorite.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm an avatar, in the most. And this is reaching back because it's a memory
yeah.
of being.
Hold that just a second. Bob, wake up.
I'm awake.
Now, do you hear? Look how he's going at this now. This is significant. It's going to be
mm-hmm.
good. To hear the words. The words are significant. When I was an avatar, there's no degree of separation there, is there?
Right.
When I was an avatar. Okay, Ken, proceed.
When I was an avatar, I had a sense of infinite amount of space, control, freedom. Complete exaltation in my imagination in a way that I hadn't experienced in any other experience, even
okay.
the physical experience.
Okay. Now, if you could flip that into your dirty here and now and move it out of the sweet by and by, that would be quite a euphoric experience, would it not?
Yeah, it truly is.
That's what we're about. We bring it into the physical right here, right now. And then if you want snow, you have snow. We have clients who wanted snow and considered it, and then bam, here's snow, 1st of October, and there's still vegetables in the garden that are freezing. They didn't consider that, and yet it did not emote anything other than snow, you see. Mm-hmm. You see, the distance between the is and the are-ness can be simultaneous. So you have, but to have a thought just in the avatar world, you have a thought in the avatar world, well, let's do this, with no regard to an outcome in the avatar world. If avatars could be killed, dispelled, defrocked, maybe, we don't know, there's lots of aspirations that you can come along there. We used it the correct way, the aspirations choking on your own vomit. If your avatar body had a recourse, you'd make different decisions. But since it did not, then it was unlimited. That's the same we wish for you. That's exactly what Marshall McLuhan was trying to portray. If you learn how to be a citizen of the global village, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well,
that's
and,
good.
And
that's good. That's good. That's good. Okay, come on, Ken.
I agree completely. I mean, I think that
we don't care if you agree. We want it to be real for you. Screw
it's real for me.
Screw agreement. Agreements are those things that are yet to be broken. We want you to know it for you. And when you know it for you, all of a sudden for you, the cares of life will absolutely grow strangely dim. And you won't have to convince anybody you're sleeping with or your family regarding it. You'll know. And they will go, honey, whatever you think. And you'll be like very surprised. Because, honey, whatever you think takes on a whole new world. It takes a whole new place. So because
I've
you've had
that
this,
experience as well.
So
you know, in the physical world, as a byproduct of not only my avatar experience, but I would say the gentleman falling asleep on the other phone there, Mr. Dobbs.
Always. Yes, of course. Of course. Now,
so
well,
the
now,
first
if
bucket
you, what,
came off the head with him.
Yes.
The first what?
The first bucket was shot off the head, right?
By Avatar Bob Dobbs. By Avatar Bob Dobbs?
Exactly.
All right.
Now, I wanted to say this, Ken, just that when he was saying about the true global village, in Mediumins and Messiahs, McLuhan says that James Joyce was able to operate in any cultural mode he encountered. That's the description of perception of global village citizen.
Mm-hmm.
He has that right there. He's able to operate in any cultural mode. And that's not the image you get of an author who's telling you a story. Joyce had a whole other agenda. And, of course, Marshall made it clear. So when Marshall's saying, we want to make you a truly global village citizen, that's indicated by that very interesting statement about Joyce.
Issy never got over it.
Who's Issy, Corinne? Or who would Issy be?
You have to go back a bit from the Joycean regime.
Well, Issy's a character in his way, but let's say, you mean the myth of the Egyptian Issy?
No. We're talking about James Joyce's Issy.
Would that be Nora?
Of course.
Okay, Nora Barnacle. Okay, gotcha. Very good. Back to you, Ken.
Come on, Bob. Stay
sure.
up. This is, you weaned off on Issy, and now you're asking like you've never heard it ever before. Imagine that. Okay, now, Ken.
I believe that as
we
I
don't care
problems.
We don't care what you believe. A belief is just a thought you've been thinking a long time. An avatar can screw you right out of your belief system in 2.3 seconds, and you have the empirical nautical data to prove it. So we really don't care what you believe, but you can tell us what you know.
Okay, I know that the experience of being an avatar extended my imaginative sphere in which I, you know, the sphere in which I project myself day to day, and in a way
that... So all you're
that
saying is it increased your force field, what we call love.
Yes, but yeah, love, exactly. And eros is a word I use all the time here, right? And
we don't care.
And
we
so,
like that. That's a good word.
Yeah, and love is a great word. Love
no,
of myself.
Love is a force field. Love's not anything other than a force field.
Truly, truly. That has enabled me in some moments to experience exactly what you're talking about as I've experienced as an avatar. In other words, to live as if there was no consequence to what was happening, to fully
not.
Let go into the
good.
Moment.
There is no consequence.
And
good.
I continue to strive towards that, you know, day-to-day perception.
Ew, that sucks.
I know.
Striving
Well, I'm telling
for
you
it.
The truth, right? What else can I say?
Oh,
right?
Good. We're so glad. Now you've got into it. Good. Describe, give us a working definition of truth. We told you you'd get your thesaurus out.
No, this one I'll work with myself.
Oh. Cool.
Well, I would just say, you know, in the most general sense, the way things actually
No. We're literal. We're not having it. If you can't find Noah Webster, go with Miriam.
Well, truth as a general concept or truth about something.
We're not interested in a general concept. We're interested in the lexicographered version of what they say truth is. Well, hold on just a second. We'll help you because this is interesting. It's good. We'll carry on our conversation. Carolyn!
Look up truth, Carol.
Yes.
Please, darling, help us. Help the brethren here.
Yes.
Look
help
up
the brethren, Carol.
I'm not your secretary, non-physical.
No. Would you please give us a Miriam...
Doesn't anyone else
mine
have a computer?
Work, they do. While you're doing that, are you guys saying Eros or Euros? What's that word you're saying, Ken?
I was saying Eros as in erotic.
E-R-O-S. Okay.
What are we looking up?
Yes.
Truth.
Mary. Anybody can look that up. That's nothing. It doesn't challenge me one little bit.
See, we got it. We got a PhD candidate, a Dr. Laureate, looking up shit for you.
Okay, truth, archaic, fidelity and constancy. B, sincerity in action, character and utterance. Number two, the state of being the case or fact. The body of real things.
This one I like, Carolyn, off Wikipedia. Agreement with fact of reality. Fact or reality. In other words, a total
don't explain
agreement
it.
With
you don't. You, we're literal. You don't have to explain it. The point is that the fact of reality, well, now you're going to jump into it because now the next thing is going to be, okay, define reality. the construct, the precept that you gauge as material. Well, if you take a murder scene, you walk in the room, there's some dead cadaver bleeding on the rug, and you're wondering how it all came about, materiality becomes the whole construct of the reality of the process. And it takes a whole lot of deducive, cognitive processes to realize that it was a butler with a pipe in the library.
Yeah, and I like the way they chop up. It's either fact or reality. You can't have both.
Very good. But now, do you see where we're playing with this here? Truth.
Hey, Ion, I like the first definition of truth in the Miriam. What was that, Carolyn? It was
fidelity, constancy, or sincerity in action. Character.
Yeah, fidelity and constancy. That's a belief you've been thinking a long time. That's
well,
what the truths are, our beliefs.
But you can be dead wrong and be very sincere.
Yeah, truth is just a belief you've been thinking a long time.
Mm-hmm. Sincerity and action, character,
that
other.
Meaning. Then there's
see,
other meanings.
That, so, Ken, now what you see how we're playing with you here now. We're just bringing up the point that what you're using as platitudes are actually vicissitudes. Mm-hmm. That's the point. What you know to be is only because that's all you know. People don't
yes.
know what they like. They like what they know. And if they don't know it, then they can't like it. You see?
Yeah.
And that
you know what that is? When they hear about the RNA drops, then they hear about the ingredients and it doesn't make any sense. They said, well, I'll wait till the FDA approval happens. That's knowing, liking what you know. That's an expression of that. I'll wait till the FDA approves it. You get that, Carol?
You only know what you know.
Yeah, and you think that the FDA, looking after you.
Then we call that the aspect of sitting on the levee waiting on the Robert E. Lee.
That's the lyrics from American Pie by Don McLean, 1970?
No.
I drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry.
Right. So what song is this one from?
Well, it would...
You're just nothing but a jukebox of song lyrics, Ian. I know that.
That would be from Tom Sawyer, Bob. It's not
okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Good. That was a good song.
Sitting on the levee, waiting on the Robert E. Lee. Good. Okay, Ken. Now we tore that up. Here's the point now, baby. We're trying to get you to the pinpoint because of your avatared experience. It gives you insight into a largerness, a more gratifying bigness, a more superfluous abstract. Superfluous abstract. We like this. Now, just discuss a little more about this avatared experience. You know, it's like tarring and feathering those with a tarred, avatared. If you play with that just a little bit, we're very thrilled and pleased beyond your words. Otherwise, we wouldn't be so combative with you because you're on to something. And what you're on to is the radical dispensational aspect that allows a biggerness of you, a bigger-ness. Gosh, Carolyn, we don't think that quite works, but a more largeness? Nope, that doesn't work. Biggerness, okay. A biggerness of you that applies into your realm or world. And your point is, validly so, that the longer you play in the avatar world, the more you can tell less the difference between this realm and that world.
I think that's true. I mean,
well, we don't care what you think, but that's okay.
No.
That is. And it's delicious because now, stay with this a second now. You're on something.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, people look at this construct and they go, oh, that's too clever by half. You see? Mm-hmm. You mix those. Many have the issue. Okay. But hold on, let's check one thing here because we want to get this exactly precise. Bob!
Yes?
Would this be the appropriate position or partition to bring up the JW window story, or is that taboo?
Well, we've told people, you're talking about in 2008, before Ion.
Well, okay, good. Now, we did
we've referred to that. I've told people
about it. We've done all we can do. We must proceed now, Ken. Okay, now you have an avatar world, okay? And the avatar world is, it's confined within the chip body, or so you thought. All right? Now,
And maybe I didn't think that. I'm not sure I thought that on.
Well, that's all right.
That's part of the breakthrough with it.
Good. Yeah. Well, we're going to break you through for sure. All right. Now, for JW, what happened was, in the same light that you know avatarism, the part you know. Now, we're not talking about the part you don't know, but the avatarism that you have been exposed to, however minutely, JW lived in a world where he had a great big house with great big windows and a great big expansive space. All right? He found that if he looked through different huge, well, we don't know what you know is huge, but pretty damn big windows. He'd look out the windows, and he would notice through the windows, which were concealed, they were completely separate from his knowingness, those windows would portray other worlds. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, that was odd to him, a bit Avatar-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would go through his great big doors, and he would look, and he would see that land, the landscape, however mysterious, was very different than what when he went back through his doors and looked through his windows. The landscape was varying and different. He even played with it to the point where he would raise the window where he was seeing different worlds, and he could look through the window, and it was that indeed world. But he'd go through his door and look at the obverse side of that very same damn window, and they would be the same as he would look into his house. There was no shift. Okay? Now, that's Avatar mm-hmm. Land 101. But that was mm-hmm. done outside of the chip body. So mm-hmm. if you could go to bed, wake up, and get up out of your bed, coitus, no coitus, we don't care, be happy, it makes no difference to us. You get up out of your bed, and all of a sudden you are your avatar, that would be strikingly significant, would it not?
It would be. It would be significant.
Describe the feeling place that sentence engaged.
Unlimited energy.
That you already have that.
Power.
You already
vision.
Have that. Good. Good.
Freedom.
You already have that. The only restrainer of you now, presently, is you. Good. Okay, good. Come on, you got some more. We weren't trying to chop you off at the legs. We were trying to get you somewhere.
No. But if I'm quiet, I'm just considering what you have to say because, you know, I sort of we were engaged in a discussion and I came back into what do you guys call it a reading, right? Or
a session. We don't use the word
session.
It's not session.
Yeah, no, I know. You guys always
we're gluten free. We're gluten free around here.
Yeah, we don't use. Yeah, no, you said not sessions. You mean not readings, Zion? It's not readings. But I had.
Yeah.
You know what? You're asking power. You already had that. Energy, you already had that. What it gives you is another self.
That's exactly what we're talking about. Now, Ken, if somehow you could connect the dots, graph, we're literal. Do not negate this. We're literal. If you mm-hmm. could graph your present locale, and you could triangulate your avatar world, then it's instantaneously achievable for you.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, do you know coffee?
Do I know the substance coffee?
Yes.
Drinking coffee?
Yep. Do you engage coffee?
I don't. I'm a mint tea guy now. I used to be a coffee guy.
Good. Okay, let's do mint tea. That's fine. That's not a problem. Do you realize the quantitative physics that are involved in the creation of mint tea?
Do I realize them all?
Yeah.
No, I don't. I rarely consider it.
You should.
Mm-hmm.
You should, because worlds have been moved with less process than your mint tea in the boiling of water and finding a cup and getting it to this right temperature, 171 degrees, by the way, is the perfect way to make that tea, and loose only, to the point, and then steeping it for 4.3 minutes only, no more, no less, as far as the perfect cup of tea. If you went to the dynamics that you call a good, quote, kiss-ka-se, good cup of tea, it would astound you. Worlds are wrought with less energy than it takes to make your damn cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? All right. Now, once you graduate, you'll find jasmine tea loose, not the pearls. There's no significance. Or a nice oolong jasmine loose tea, and then you'll even have a larger gratification process, because if you only knew that you could have an entire another world easier, then you could enjoy or steep or have or be, well, you don't even do it, so whatever, but enjoying that tea that you call as normal, that construct alone would shift your whole paradigm. Because that's what we're talking mm-hmm. about here. That's what you mm-hmm. ought to be telling your damn students, but they aren't listening anyway, so we don't know why you'd bother. But
I mentioned to them this morning the Steve Jobs moment, and one of them astutely said,
"Oh well, the Steve Jobs moment. Develop that just a bit. We're on
that." So so the medium gave the message, and I thought that was a breakthrough that they even knew what the hell, that probe was by McLuhan. So
well, but yet his whole life is validated by Dr. Seuss.
Anyway, I don't want to divert from what we were.
You're fine. Don't be sad that I'm gone. Smile because I happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. He didn't have to go. He chose to go.
That's what Dr. Seuss said, Ken.
Right.
Don't be sad that he went, but be smiled at what happened.
Steve Jobs, happened. But then we pinpointed this already in advance, trying to give you all a heads up on your payday show, but nobody bothers to listen, so it's all right.
Hey, Ian, why did Steve go? Why did he commit suicide?
You'll see.
Okay, you're going to develop it, or that's another time? You're going to develop it in this, what you're saying now?
It's not done yet. It's why you didn't get a 5, a piss pod 5. We went over this in payday, Bob. You didn't get a piss pod 5. You got a P pod 4S.
And he committed suicide because he couldn't make the 5.
No, he could make the 5, but it's coming. He's not through. Just jet down, Bob.
Steve did not fake his death. Steve Jobs did not fake his death. He transitioned.
That's correct. He chose.
Did he go to the Guff?
He's on the way.
Is he visiting other parallel worlds?
Not yet.
Is he deciding to come to do some things here still? That's why you're saying he's not finished?
He's in an Amari pot. Going to go further, or are you done?
Carolyn doesn't know what a Amari pot is, so nobody knows.
Japanese pottery.
Oh, okay. He's inside that.
Right now.
You mean they cremated him?
No.
Well, why is he in this pot?
He chose.
And where is that pot?
On J.W.'s shelf in his study.
Ah, there's more to that than you would know, Ken. That's not so far off as... what do you think of that, Ken? We're getting the autopsy of Steve Jobs here, thanks to your return.
Well, it's perfect. And sorry about the disconnect, but we had to connect. Because our only limitation in non-physical is participation. And see, if you don't have participation, you're pissing in the wind, and what's the point? It's kind of like your classroom, isn't it?
Yeah, truly. I think all of the things that you said were wonderfully
congratulations. Now ask something that's interesting, because we don't care what we already know. So ask something. Come on, you got it. You got the tiger by the tail, so get with it.
So, did you finish explaining, let me say this, Ken, did you finish explaining the relevance of JW's Windows experience to being an avatar? Did you finish your point, Ion?
Well, okay. Now, Ken, do you have any questions regarding the construct that was presented with JW's Great Big Windows and your avatar experience. Because what we laid out here is that an avatar position, the only difference between a chip body experience and looking through a window is a perspective. So if the only shift to that is perspective, then that perspective then is relative. Oh, there is reality. Aha, there you go. So the point of the conversation is just as you know that you engaged in an avatar-ish world, no question there, correct, Ken?
Yep.
JW had the very exact same, well, maybe even more, experience even in his casa.
In the liberation.
So
he had a liberating effect like that Ken got.
And then he tried it in a couple of his other casas, because he's got lots of casas, and those applied as well. Same place, same
way. And so
way.
Was it accidental, or was there some kind of...
There are no accidents.
But did he do anything specifically to engage with that experience?
Oh, he didn't push against anything. Just like you, see... If you pushed against the avatar crap, you'd have never got anywhere. You see? Had you pushed against any aspect or ramification regarding an experience, it would have nullified the experience. But then that's what old physics used to say already, huh?
Yes. So the fact with which the... which I dove in, as it were, was the determining factor in the experience.
It pierced the veil that Marshall McLuhan spoke about over and over and over. It literally deferred categorical, expressionable reality.
And so, in waking up in the morning... I know what my avatar feels like. I know what it feels like to be that avatar, and I can embody that spirit. And so I get up.
Well, no, not the spirit.
I take a deep breath.
No. Wait, now. Not the spirit of the avatar. The avatar. See, fuck
yes.
The spirit business. Fuck the spirit.
No, I agree with you completely.
Because that's the sweet by and by. We're not talking about that. We could give a crap about that. We're talking about the dirty here and now.
Yep. Yeah.
The sticky part of the lovemaking, that's when it's good. If you ain't getting sticky, you ain't doing it right. But if you're sticky, then you're doing it right. That's the point. And there's nothing esoterically spiritual regarding that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if
everybody's
happy.
Yeah, did you say that McLuhan deferred about a minute ago? Used the word deferred. Okay.
Yes.
He deferred the reality.
Of course. Otherwise, how do you get the confines of the construct of the global village, Bob? Come on. This is old school.
So, what were we saying there?
What were we saying here? Bob didn't last long, but he's as good once as he ever was. That's for sure. Okay, Ken. Okay, now, knowing what you... No. Let's soften it. We want to get you clear. That's significant here. We want to get you clear. Ask them other questions. Anything, any crazy damn thing you want to ask, and we'll apply it back to something McLuhan-esque, we promise. Other than Mary, and we love Mary.
Is Twitter Finnegan's Wake revisited?
No,
or
it is not.
Or recast?
The cipher for Finnegan's Wake is a word that we have laid out for those that are working on it, and we're not going to give it here. But we have acknowledged it already.
The play for cipher is the phrase he used. Ion claims there's a play for cipher that implied a Finnegan's Wake.
Claim. This isn't.
Hey, this is civilized discourse. You don't shine your ego all over the place like that. You pretend that you're working on it. That's the way we talk here.
Well.
Well, you can't take that. Well, you're speechless.
Well, claim. Yeah, that's claim. Yeah, yeah,
I claim.
If we can afford the deductible, we're going to proceed with a claim, right, Bob?
In the same way that, you know, you're talking about the windows and you're talking about the virtual environments,
uh-huh.
And so we're talking about seeing the world that your emotions or your what you know to be true right now is is actually seeing, right? Just seeing what you're really seeing.
Well, but see, this to see is past tense. You see, you look at yourself, and you get up and you shave your ugly mug, and you comb your hair, and you brush them teeth, and you make sure everything looks the way it's supposed to look, correct?
Yep.
But see, you do realize that with the present form of physics, when you look in the mirror, that's a historical position for you.
Yeah, no, I heard that in one of the talks the other day. I mean, because of the speed of light, right?
Well, if
your
eyes
actually looking
have
at
to
an
get
after
it,
image.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's why the stars are in your eyes, because that's past. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So
yeah,
and
yeah,
if
yeah,
we
yeah.
if we lay that parameter even into that simple process, and we have proof of that, women go out of their house with their slips 4 inches below the skirt tail, and your question kind of becomes, what the fuck mirror were you using when you looked at yourself to say that everything was good, and then all of a sudden you slip 4 inches below your skirt tail, you see? Do they just want you to know that they're wearing foundational garments? No, they didn't, quote, see it, you see? So even in that gaze, and you know this more than others, because in the avatar world, it is instantaneous. So is our world instantaneous. Mm-hmm. So Ion, you're saying that you should be able to look in the mirror and see your hair grow? And we say, absolutely. You're going, now, wait a second now, hair doesn't grow that fast. Well, there is no time. So that's relative, isn't it? But yet you trust a Botox injection to smooth out the damn wrinkles while you wait. You see? And that's and so is Botox real? Well, you look at it and go, yeah, there's a definable definition for Botox. It's botulism. You inject it in your skin. It fills the skin, so there's no wrinkles. So it's an applique that you inject that has an outcome or a prescribed vexing position. Doesn't last, but it's instantaneous. Yes? And so they say, what you're talking about in the avatar world is not real, and Botox is. And yet you say, but the avatar world lasts longer than the Botox that you get the engagement from. Do you see how we twist
this up? I would say completely that the avatar world is more real than something that artificially changes you.
Very
because
good.
The
see,
avatar world
the physical,
is an unfolding.
You know? The physical is artificial. What you're calling avatar is as real as reality.
More real, hyper real.
Well, now
than
now,
what people call, you know, what than what people or even myself calls reality.
Based on what Dr. Dean read as a definition, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, let's bring the avatar world into your this existence. This now Marshall would talk about the plane of essence. You remember that?
I don't remember it, but it's a great
The plane of existence regarding essence. Post-Playboy interview, when he was trying to come into his guff, his one for the Gipper.
You mean when he transitioned?
No, before.
Okay, after the Playboy interview. Hey, Bolton, the governor of the Bank of England said a few hours ago, the world is facing the worst financial crisis since at least the 1930s, if not ever.
Of course.
It's over.
We said that 2 damn years ago, Bob.
I know. It on the radio.
Yeah. It's over.
We're forcing them to say uncle. They're starting to say uncle.
Well, then they've already blamed it on parallel worlds. So
welcome
to our experience. Okay. So now, Ken. Now, what we're saying here. Now, this is good. If there's an if clause here, you know how to apply an if clause grammatically, correct?
Yes.
All right. If your avatar experience is more, we don't like your word, but we'll go with your word, hyper real. If it's more real than what you call getting up, taking a shower, shaving, taking a shower, brushing your teeth, combing your hair, putting on your clothes, going to teach those blithering idiots. If your avatar world is more hyper-real than your day-to-day engagement, doesn't that bring into question your sense of knowing and reality?
Well, it certainly does, because for a couple of years they were the same thing.
Well,
I got paid to be an avatar.
Well, paid is relative. Your wife got paid for having relations with you, and she didn't clock a card, did she? And yet you had orgasmic interactions that were pleasurable for you, correct?
Yes, as opposed to the orgasmic interactions that were unpleasurable, but yes.
Well, we hope they weren't unpleasurable, and you're not doing it.
No,
right.
I'm being facetious, right? I mean,
well, we are.
Isn't orgasm good, right?
Because that position, see, becomes the vacillation of the distance between joy and happiness. Mm-hmm. See, we're not even about joy anymore. We're about bliss.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do it right, it's bliss. And if you don't know what you're doing, it can be joyful. And if you really don't know what you can do, it can be happy. And if you're trying to figure that out, you'll get a divorce.
If you're trying to figure out what?
The distance between bliss and happy.
You'll get a divorce, you get lost in the attempt.
Correct. And see, and that's the whole thing. And that's what we're trying to lay out here a little bit for you here, which is delicious because of your insight in causal realities. Do you know that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us what you think causal realities are.
You
didn't know there was going to be a test at the end of this quiz, did you?
No, the whole thing is a test for me after a long day.
You have no idea.
You guys rock me to sleep every night over the last few months. So,
it's sort of like my evening,
only I get to actually talk and people hear, which is nice.
You do.
You
don't know if they hear.
Causal reality.
No. You assume they hear.
Mm-hmm.
You're counting on them hearing, but you don't know that they hear. See, that's the relegation. That's the relegation between live and Memorex. That's our point. What you're living in right here, right now, your virtual avatarish world, maybe had, based on your definitions now, maybe more real, hyper real, or hyper reality, which is what Marshall laid out. From itch, the point in what he had problem with Wyndham Lewis regarding was the whole point that what you're looking at isn't real and what you can't see is real.
Right. Mm-hmm.
No reference to Gaza there.
Mm-hmm. None intended or taken.
Who's Gaza?
Israel.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, so now, if that's the case, and if you can ponder, consider, or placate your position from that venue, everything takes on a whole new construct, does it not?
Yes, absolutely. And
develop
for me,
it.
I've had flashes of that experience because of my experience as an avatar. But even talking to you now, I mean, I can start to embody the impulses of my avatar. I have been since we, you know, the last few minutes. I've started feel as if I was that avatar in that virtual space, and it's a very profound experience for me, and one that's easily
Now, is your avatar more high and tight than you?
You mean physically, like how
well,
it looks?
Well, duh, yeah.
Sorry. A little bit, but actually fairly parallel.
So your meat-sack body is balanced, and you don't have to ask your avatar if you think your penis is disproportionate to your meat-sack body, right?
No, I don't have to. I've always tried to represent myself as I felt myself to be.
Okay.
And so that's,
but that's
changed,
but that's,
over a period of time.
But that's relative, because you could notice your shift and change. Now, your point early on, which we were like chomping at the bit to jump in on, was that you become what your avatar is.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Now that's Ion 101, and it's also McLuhan 101. That the construct that you use.
Carpenter 101.
Well, the gauge that you use to base. To base your locality is only relegated to your transposed position of reality. Boy, there's a whole lot of syntax here. So if you see yourself exercising as an avatar, you lose weight. If you see yourself as, we don't know, beautiful, handsome, we don't know the word. I mean, because... See, ugly girls sleep with everybody, and pretty girls sleep with everybody, so we really don't quite get it after just a little bit. I mean, you know, Bob was going to open a house of ill repute till he found out that the high school girls were giving it away for free, and it kind of broke the business model that he was working within the confines regarding. But the point is, it has very little to do with anything after a little bit, less than except of engagement. All right. So if there is indeed engagement, all of a sudden everything's out the window within the human construct.
And do you mean, sorry, are you pausing dramatically there, or are you?
Well, no.
Are you finished?
We were finished.
Yes.
And we're going to have to wrap it up.
Well, my goodness. It's more than I could have ever expected. I thought to sort of pop in at the end of a conversation.
We were holding back till you got back. So it's
thank
all
good. You, Brian. I actually think that, you know, you addressed things that in my listening of your other shows and other appearances throughout Bob's lexicon here that have already kind of been reflected back to me, that I've already been considered. But I think that, your suggestion of carpe diem with the whole thing is well taken. Thank you.
Better than a non sequitur, isn't it?
Better, I guess indeed. Better than
we're very literal. Don't play with us. We're with you, big boy. Now, the good part is this comes into an abject perception. Now we were going to say perspective, but it's actually a perception because it's not even a perspective. Once you start coming into this place, and if the avatar world is, and you can embrace that, then other worlds certainly should be a piece of cake.
I feel that way right now. I'm excited to dive in a bit.
Good. Let's get your penis wet, and then you'll be confirmed. You see, because until it becomes real in your introspect, there's always it's always subject to question. And that's the question has nothing to do with knowing. Because once you know, then you know. Well, once you know, then there's no backing up. You can never unknow.
Yep.
You may forget, but forgetting, you have to engage. So you're saying that memory is required for knowing. And we go, hell no, because once you know, you know. You don't have to remember to have an erection. You know you have an erection. You
right.
see, the autonomic responses that are the capacitation of the aspect or intersection of your places of joy are relative, and it makes it from physical. If you wake up in the night and you're dry as a gourd and you're just dying, you have some water, you get the water, you drink the water, and now you're hydrated. You don't have to remember you're thirsty. Get up in the morning, you're ready for a great big breakfast because you've had midnight activities and you're about wore out, and you get up and you're starving, you're ravenous, so you eat. You don't have to remember you're hungry any more than you have to remember that your godship is at hand. You don't have to remind your avatar to go have fun, do you? Exactly. And that's what we're talking about, the slip and the difference. And that's Marshall McLuhan 101. If you get that aspect, then McLuhan is a piece of cake. We said that already, didn't we? It's a piece of cake.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ken. Thanks a lot, Ion. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
You made this a marvelous interaction.
Well, thank you as well. I look forward to following up with you at some time, Bob.
Yeah, email me.
I will for sure.
Okay, great.
Therefore, we are totally, deliciously, happily, and forever, Florence Nightingale. Hey.
JW, you still here, Ken?
Yeah, I am. That's the breath, right?
Yeah, that's Ion has left or returned or who knows. But now we have JW.
Hey.
Hi,
so
thank you.
Fun.
Yeah, we had a very good session.
Bob, who's here?
Ken Hudson. He's,
Ken.
Hey,
Ken. It's hey, Avatar. JW. Avatar.
Yeah.
Business. Go. That's fun. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It was incredibly insightful.
Fun.
Thank you.
Now it's going to download. It hasn't quite yet, but it will. But there's a pretty fun connection. That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Ken was part of our McLuhan dialogue. Then he had to go, and so then we talked.
No. He didn't have to go. We had to go so you get to the good part, and he had to come back.
Right, so then he came back, and then we did another hour with
that.
Ken.
Yeah, that's good.
It's all about the entrance, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's all about the outro, right?
Yep.
Very, very wonderful. Thank you very, very much, and are you good, Bob?
Yes, I will now stop the recording. I need to go over here. Carolyn has to disconnect. Click this off.